Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Coming up, a discussion on possible reparations to African Americans for slavery. A panel including Congressman John Conyers,
Black lawmakers resentful after Conyers' resignation, by John Bresnahan. The stunning fall of Democratic Representative John Conyers, who resigned Tuesday amid a growing sexual harassment scandal, has left confusion, anger, resentment, and bewilderment inside the ranks of the Congressional Black Caucus, a group that Conyers helped found nearly four decades ago. Many CBC members see a double standard at play. They won't say the treatment of Conyers is racist, necessarily, and all express strong support for his alleged victims. But they think white politicians accused of similar misconduct, like Blake Farenthold, Al Franken, Roy Moore, and Donald Trump, get a benefit of the doubt that black politicians don't enjoy. Some members believe House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, Democrat California, and other party leaders moved too quickly in calling on Conyers to resign and should have let the process play out more, although they understand the pressure she was facing. And still another faction thinks Conyers' declining health and mental acuity after more than 52 years in Congress led to the debacle, despite evidence that Conyers allegedly had been harassing female staffers for years. There is also significant anger within the CBC aimed at one of their own, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, Democrat, Texas. Conyers was going to announce his retirement from Congress last Friday. Then Monica Conyers, the congressman's wife, and Jackson Lee got involved and stopped it from happening, said several Democratic lawmakers and aides. That decision dragged out the controversy for 5 days, although the delay ultimately allowed Conyers to endorse his son, John Conyers III, for his seat. Ian Conyers, the congressman's grandnephew, and a Michigan state senator also may run, setting off an intra-family battle. Certainly it seems as if there is indeed a double standard, said Representative Marsha Fudge, Democrat, Ohio, who was involved in Conyers' retirement negotiations last week before Jackson Lee and Monica Conyers derailed them. When it happens to one of us, we're guilty until proven innocent. They're just finally starting to talk about Blake Farenthold, who is a member sitting here who paid out $84,000. A former Farenthold aide, Lauren Green, received that settlement payment after filing a lawsuit against the Texas Republican, claiming gender discrimination and a hostile workplace, with sexual harassment a key part of that claim. Do I think he was treated like everyone? No, he wasn't. I think it was an easy call for people to talk about him, added Representative Cedric Richmond, Democrat, Louisiana, CBC chairman. You didn't see Speaker Ryan calling for the resignation of Blake Farenthold, who settled a case. Conyers denies it. Franken admits it. Franken, a Democratic senator from Minnesota, has been accused of inappropriately touching or attempting to forcibly kiss 6 women. Franken is now under ethics investigation, but has refused to resign. It's a horrible situation, and if the allegations are true, then retirement or resignation was appropriate, Richmond added. The problem for me was I had the congressman vehemently denying it, and I have very credible-sounding victims. When the deal goes down, John isn't well. He was beginning to suffer memory loss, and physically he isn't well, said Representative Alcy Hastings, Democrat, Florida, who faced an ethics investigation and lawsuit over sexual harassment 5 years ago, both of which were later dismissed. But sure, there are members of the Congressional Black Caucus who feel John was done in. I respect that, but I don't have that feeling. Conyers allegedly harassed several former aides, including an ex-staffer who received a $27,000 settlement using taxpayer funds. After initially seeming to downplay the allegations against him, Pelosi quickly changed course, and by Thursday she was calling for Conyers to resign. Representative Jim Clyburn, Democrat, South Carolina, the highest-ranking black lawmaker in Congress, also called on Conyers to resign, a huge blow to the Michigan Democrat. But Conyers, who had been hospitalized for stress-related symptoms, refused to leave office initially, and there were signs he intended to try to fight off an ethics committee investigation. Congressman Conyers has served in the Congress for more than five decades and shaped some of the most consequential legislation of the last half century, Pelosi said in a statement. But no matter how great the legacy, it is no license to harass or discriminate. This was as much about Pelosi's own politics as it was about Conyers, said a CBC member, speaking on the condition of anonymity. I think she was forced into it, and I think it was very unfortunate. Pelosi has come under fire for not taking a harder line against Conyers from the start, especially amid a broader push across the country to crack down on sexual harassment and assault. Yet Richmond, for his part, doesn't blame Pelosi. I don't think she was unfair to him, Richmond said. Part of it was unfortunately he got sick and went into the hospital and couldn't defend himself. But only he knows and the victims know what happened. Looking at the amount of victims, it was troubling, and there was no way around it. Behind the scenes, there was an attempt to end this controversy last week, yet it fell apart under pressure from Monica Conyers and Jackson Lee. According to lawmakers and aides, Fudge had brokered an arrangement that would save some face for Conyers while removing a big problem for Democrats. After some delicate negotiations, Fudge was going to read a letter on the House floor last Friday, announcing Conyers would retire at the end of December. By calling it retirement and not resignation, the move would give Conyers a last shred of dignity, said one source familiar with the discussions. Conyers would have time to clean out his Capitol Hill and Detroit offices. In return, Conyers would avoid an investigation by the House Ethics Committee that could lead to censure or expulsion. Then Jackson Lee and Monica Conyers weighed in against the deal, and it was taken off the table, dragging out the scandal, said the sources. People are furious with her, one CBC member said of Jackson Lee, absolutely furious. When asked about her interactions with Monica Conyers, Jackson Lee said she cannot comment on anything involving Mr. Conyers. I am not Mr. Conyers. Jackson Lee added, I have not spoken with Mr. Conyers. I have nothing to do with his decision. Jackson Lee would not discuss any conversation with Monica Conyers, who has emerged as a key player in the saga. Monica Conyers was seen by CBC members and Democratic aides as the driving force behind Conyers' refusal to resign. Some lawmakers even speculate that Monica Conyers was trying to position herself or one of her sons to run for the seat, which is what eventually happened. Monica Conyers berated reporters staking out the family home in Detroit last week. Do you all go and stalk other people's houses? She asked reporters, according to the Detroit Free Press. Do you go and stalk white people's houses or just come to the black neighborhoods and stalk our houses? The couple met when Monica Conyers was an aide on his campaign in the late 1980s. They were married in 1990 and have two children. She was elected to the Detroit City Council in 2005. In 2009, Monica Conyers pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit bribery in connection with a Detroit sludge hauling scandal. As a member of the City Council 2 years earlier, she cast the deciding vote in favor of awarding a $1.2 billion contract to Synagro Technologies. She ended up serving 27 months in federal prison in West Virginia.
The fact is, Anderson, we got two cultures down here, white culture and the colored culture. Now, that's the way it always has been. That's the way it always will be.
The rest of America don't see it that way, Mr. Mayor.
Rest of America don't mean jack shit.
You in Mississippi now.
President Trump is drawing criticism from civil rights groups who are upset about his weekend plans. The president is scheduled to be in Jackson, Mississippi tomorrow when the state opens a civil rights museum as part of bicentennial events. Mississippi is the setting for a key chapter in the nation's struggle for equality. But the state has been slow to acknowledge the racism and violence in its past. The new museum now tells that difficult story. NPR's Debbie Elliott has a preview.
Okay, everybody come on in.
As construction workers put up the last exhibits, Mississippi Civil Rights Museum director Pamela Jr. shows a small group the developing galleries.
This is the beginning. Africans coming over through the transatlantic slave trade.
We journey through the Emancipation Proclamation and Reconstruction. Then a turn into a room dominated by a tree, its limbs sprawling overhead.
This tree here is a lot of symbolism to me because we're walking into some deep times now. And it's not only you see, think about the tree and lynching, but you look at the images, Jim Crow images that are up as leaves are on the limbs of the trees. This is when it starts getting dark. Let's go on in a little bit.
Junior says visitors will experience cramped and dark spaces as they move through the museum's galleries.
The movement was very uncomfortable. I want them to feel uncomfortable so they can understand that once they get out of this tunnel, that they're going to come to light. And their challenge is to make Mississippi the best Mississippi that they can.
Junior says they will encourage visitors to leave the museum and then travel around the state to learn more at key historical sites. And there are plenty. Bryant's Grocery, where Emmett Till was fatefully accused of flirting with a white shopkeeper. Voting rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer's grave. And the Neshoba County Memorial to three civil rights workers killed by the Ku Klux Klan during Freedom Summer.
Mississippi's ground zero when it comes to civil rights.
State Senator Hillman Frazier of Jackson was instrumental in getting legislation passed for the new museum and served on the planning committee. It was a long time coming, he says.
Folks thought that we should forget about it, part of history, don't tell the story, and just don't bring up anything that's painful. But that's part of our history.
Civil rights tourism has taken off in other states. For instance, in Alabama, where the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute and the Rosa Parks Museum in Montgomery are a big draw. In 2006, Republican Governor Haley Barbour helped push the Mississippi Project forward, seeing the economic benefit. But to secure funding from the legislature, Frazier says the Civil Rights Museum was paired with a state history museum, giving lawmakers political cover to approve it.
Some just want to vote for a straight-up Civil Rights Museum because of this district they represent, and they just want to bring those issues up.
State officials reject the idea that the dual museums represent a continuation of the separate but equal doctrine and say they complement one another. Set in downtown Jackson near the state archives, the two buildings are joined by a common lobby. The History Museum gives a broad overview.
The Civil War transformed Mississippi.
It spans from the Stone Age and Native American cultures through the Great Mississippi River Flood of 1927 to Hurricane Katrina. The Civil Rights Museum brings a deeper focus to the 30-year period when Mississippi was at the center of the movement. Foot soldiers have donated artifacts, including the family of murdered Hattiesburg NAACP leader Vernon Damer. He was targeted for offering to pay the poll tax for African Americans who wanted to vote. Damer was killed in 1966 when the KKK firebombed his home and surrounded it, waiting to shoot to death anyone who tried to escape the burning house.
That was a horrible night.
Ellie Damer is Vernon Damer's 92-year-old widow. She says she never thought she'd see it documented in a museum.
We lived it, and some of them died with it. The rest of Mississippi needs to know about it.
Museum director Pamela Jr. shows the family a photograph of the four oldest sons who returned from the military after their father was killed. They're standing by the remains of the family home.
You see the brothers, all with uniforms on, and what do I say? I say that his sons were fighting for America. And Mr. Damer was here in Mississippi fighting to be an American. This is amazing. Amazing piece right here. Amazing.
So Vernon Damer Jr. stops to gather himself when he sees the picture.
Yeah, that was a tough day.
Yeah.
You know, to have to come home and look at where we were raised and reflect back on the memories of growing up. Mm-hmm. And it didn't need to happen.
He's moved by the museum's treatment of Mississippi's brutal past.
We've come a long way, and it's something that we can all be proud of. We've got a long way to go. So today I stand here, and I'm very, very proud and very pleased what I've been able to see.
His brother Dennis Damer was 11 at the time.
What they did to send a message to terrorize black folks and people sympathetic to black folks.
Despite a confession from one of the Klansmen, it was more than 30 years before Mississippi convicted a KKK Grand Wizard for Damer's murder. Ellie Damer says progress has been slow, and it's up to white people now to see it through.
If as many of them will stand as the blacks stood in 66, we'll see a change in Mississippi. But you all are going to have to take a stand. We've already stood.
Now a new controversy has developed after Republican Governor Phil Bryant invited President Trump to the museum's opening. Georgia Congressman John Lewis, a Democrat and civil rights icon, has canceled his plans to participate in Saturday's dedication. Lewis and Mississippi Democratic Congressman Benny Thompson say it's an insult for Trump to be there given his response to white nationalist rallies and other racially divisive comments. Governor Bryant is rejecting calls to revoke the invitation.
Well, it's just sad. The President of the United States should be able, and we're very thankful that he is, going to come for this historic occasion. This is
Bryant says the President will honor Mississippi with his presence. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Jackson.
I want to be a cop.
Because you're white male privileged, so you wouldn't know.
I'm sorry.
Tonight, the Plainfield police captain that said those words is staying on the job after a decision from the police board. The story has sparked national headlines, some calling the comments racist. Call 6 Investigates' Paris Lavelle has been following the story from the beginning. He was at that meeting tonight in Paris. This is not the first time that this officer has been in trouble.
That's right, Raphael. She was actually disciplined and demoted earlier this year. Captain Carrie Weber violated the department's alcohol policy. And now this is the second investigation into her conduct. But tonight, she's keeping her job.
After finding Captain Weber to be fit for duty, I move that she be removed from administrative leave and return to her present position and job responsibilities.
The decision coming from the Plainfield Police Commissioners after Captain Carrie Weber was placed on administrative leave in November for this comment.
Because you're white male privileged, so you wouldn't know.
The city says the comment came during a transgender awareness training session the department was going through by the U.S. Department of Justice. After another officer in the room questioned statistics that transgender people are more likely to experience police violence compared to non-transgender people.
Most of the people that I know have never been accused of police of violence. So I guess I don't get where that statistic comes from.
That male officer, later identified by the city as Captain Scott Arnett, filed a complaint against Weber and she was placed on administrative leave. But because Weber had already been suspended for 2 weeks earlier this year for violating the department's alcohol policy by driving her department-issued squad car after drinking at a golf outing and transporting alcohol inside the vehicle, it was up to the police commissioners to make the decision on her future with the department.
Meeting of the Plainfield Metropolitan Police Commissioners Board.
That decision coming Thursday night in a packed room at Plainfield Police Headquarters. Supporters from both sides of the issue were there as the decision was made.
He was arguing against the statistics, saying, you know, transgender people aren't discriminated against. And I know that that's true, not true. I know that, you know, my friends are afraid of the police.
Plainfield Police Department has exonerated her for this and does not believe that there's a situation for dismissal from the force. I totally disagree with that. In my opinion, she's a racist, and there's no room in our public and our society for that.
All right, Raphael, Captain Carrie Weber was reprimanded. A note was placed in her file for disrupting the training session and improper handling of an issue with a subordinate. Now, Captain Scott Arnett, the male in that incident, was also disciplined earlier this month. He received a 2-day suspension.
So what is the department saying about this now?
Raphael, they're saying they just want to move forward. They regret the situation occurred, but they're looking forward to that resolution.
Well, Paris Lavelle leading our coverage tonight. Thank you so much.
When you're a cop, you can torment freely and see me valley, then seize an Audi, then beam proudly to the routine traffic stop to your season finale when you're a cop.
As you heard here last month, the San Joaquin County Sheriff is being accused of abusing his office to influence death investigations, including hiding evidence in order to shield law enforcement officers. KQED's Julie Small has an update and a warning. The story is graphic.
The county's chief forensic pathologist, Dr. Bennett Omalu, is alleging a pattern of abuse in which the sheriff has interfered with his work and disregarded the findings of autopsies. The nationally recognized pathologist wrote notes detailing his concerns about Sheriff Coroner Steve Moore. He wrote that the sheriff had withheld information, and in three cases involving people who died either in custody or during arrest, Moore certified the death as an accident instead of a homicide, as Omalu believes the medical findings indicated. The sheriff does whatever he feels like doing as the coroner, in total disregard of bioethics, standards of practice of medicine, and the generally accepted principles of medicine, Omalu wrote in an August memo presented to the county administration yesterday. The county district attorney said her office is looking into the allegations. Omalu's colleague, Dr. Susan Parson, quit her job with the county last week, saying she had lost faith in the ability to work independently. Both doctors declined to be recorded for this story, but asked Patricia Hernandez with the Union of American Physicians and Dentists to speak for them.
If this was something that was made public, I think that many citizens would question it and would demand change.
Sheriff Moore is an elected official, and as in 49 other counties, he serves as both the top law enforcement officer and the county coroner. He denies the claim that he meddled in forensic investigations. As coroner, I have not interfered. I've never changed any cause of death, he told KQED yesterday. Moore also declined to be recorded. He said determining cause of death, what killed a person, is the purview of the forensic pathologist. By law, his job as the coroner is to determine the manner, whether the death is an accident, a homicide, a suicide, a result of natural causes, or undetermined. Moore said, I do that based on the totality of the circumstances, up to and including the autopsy report provided by the doctor and the investigative report done by the coroner's investigators. But Drs. Omalu and Parson alleged the sheriff's department kept them from visiting crime scenes to gather information needed for independent analysis, then didn't turn over investigatory reports. Again, Pat Hernandez.
It's very important for the sheriff to be transparent and to provide the information that the doctors need. Otherwise, they cannot conduct their work.
In one of the more graphic details, the doctors both complained about a sheriff sergeant who went behind their backs and ordered forensic technicians to cut the hands off at least five bodies for fingerprinting, something they said is done only rarely for badly decomposed bodies. The sheriff told us his department needed to send the hands to a special lab for help with identification, but the doctor said it was not necessary in these cases. Omalu went so far as to claim systematic bias, flaws, and corruption, and he alleges the sheriff failed to share some key evidence in the case of a father who died after a police chase.
It was only reported that he was tased twice, and in reality, he was tased 31 times. There's a big difference in that, and I'm not sure how that can be overlooked or swept under a carpet like it was.
I'll have more on that part of the story tomorrow. For the California Report, I'm Julie Small.
When we first heard on the television that a police officer had gunned down an unarmed African-American in North Charleston by the name of Walter Scott, there were some who said, wow. The national story has come home to South Carolina. But there were many who said there is no way that a police officer would ever shoot somebody in the back 6, 7, 8 times. But like Thomas, when we were able to see the video and we were able to see the gunshots and when we saw him fall to the ground and when we saw the police officer come and handcuff him on the ground, without even trying to resuscitate him, without even seeing if he was really alive, without calling an ambulance, without calling for help, and to see him die face down in the ground as if he were gunned down like game. I believe we all were like Thomas and said, I believe.
20 years, that was the sentence handed down to former North Charleston police officer Michael Slager today. We have team coverage tonight from the federal courthouse in downtown Charleston. Our team has been there for all of the proceedings from the state trial, which ended in a hung jury, to this federal sentencing hearing. We were there as Walter Scott's family learned the fate of the man who shot and killed their beloved son, brother, and father. Bill Sharp joining me now. Bill, an emotional ending to a case that has sparked controversy not only here in the Lowcountry, but all across the nation.
And today, Debbie, there was nothing like today in terms of emotion, crying from both families. We'll get into that in just a minute. In the meantime, the family of Walter Scott says justice was served today by the 20-year prison sentence given out to Michael Slager by Judge David Norton. But the family says that still hasn't erased the pain of the past 2.5 years since this tragic shooting occurred. Police reporter Harp Jacobs joins me now. Harp, some of the family members said in court they've had to relive the shooting over and over and over again when they see that infamous video.
Yeah, Bill, that cell phone video of the shooting. In fact, Walter Scott's brother, one of his brothers said he's seen his brother killed on video thousands of times. That's exactly what he said. The Scott family says today was an historic day because a white police officer is going to prison for killing an unarmed black man. Their words. They praise Faden Santana, who shot the cell phone video of the shooting, saying without that video, Michael Slager might still be on the police force. They also noted how the death of their loved one brought about change with a law requiring body cameras for police officers. Bill, Walter Scott's brother Rodney said, now that Michael Slager's on his way to prison, it's time to move on, but he said the family will never, ever forget what happened.
So move on and forgive, but never forget.
Right.
Police reporter Harv Jacobs. There was emotion, a lot of it, on both sides of the aisle, both families. At one point, Michael Slager himself broke down on the witness stand. Alexis Simmons has more on the emotion of the day. Alexis?
Well, Michael Slager and Walter Scott's family were trying to fight back tears as they were in the courtroom sharing their statements about their loved ones. Now, Slager's wife said that her heart breaks, that she can't redo what happened, and that she asked the judge for mercy. Now, that's one of the first times today in court we actually got to learn more about Walter Scott's interests. His family talked about how he sang in the church choir, was a family man, and loved to play board games. Now, several members also took their time to say they forgive Michael Slager, and that there was various moments when Slager wiped away his tears, as you mentioned, Bill. Now take a listen to what Walter Scott's brother had to say after the sentencing.
But we are head held high and proud to be here today and still seeking justice for Walter. And the process, you know, other families may not receive this, but we have set a roadmap for them to follow, to believe in God, and try to keep the peace.
Goes out to the other families that did not receive justice. Now, Walter Scott's brother also mentioned some of the good that has come out of this case in the fact that there is a state body cam law that is going to be requiring all law enforcement officers to wear body cameras. Back to you, Bill.
Alexis, thank you. We believe Michael Slager is in the Charleston County Jail tonight, awaiting his sentencing. At some point, the feds at the federal level will decide where to send him, somewhere in the country in the federal penal system. In the meantime, both sides, I think, both families feel now is a time for the healing to begin. Debbie, I'll throw it back to you.
Thank you, Bill, Harv, and Alexis downtown. A number of officials have made statements following the sentencing, but before the official sentencing was handed down, State Representative Wendell Gilliard said whatever the decision, both families will be negatively impacted. He went on to say, we the people are all responsible in some way because of the rise in hate and prejudice in our society. He said we need more participants and fewer critics to keep moving toward a positive change. change. We'll continue to bring you any updates and the absolute latest moving forward. Also, legal analyst Charlie Condon will join me tonight with more on guidelines used to decide this sentence.
Why haven't you learned anything?
A teacher who was overheard making racial comments prior to a boys' basketball game in Forest City last week has now decided to resign.
They're all foreigners.
Exactly, all foreigners.
At a meeting today, the Forest City Board of Education accepted the resignation of third grade teacher Holly Jane Cusero-Smith. It read in part, "The comments I made were inappropriate and not a true reflection of who I am or what I believe. I had no idea a private conversation would become a public issue." That conversation could be overheard during online coverage prior to a basketball game between Forest City and Eagle Grove last Tuesday. Commentary was being provided by KIOW radio broadcaster Orrin Harris, who was heard talking to Cusero-Smith about the names of certain Eagle Grove players that the two believed sounded Hispanic. Earlier this week, Harris was fired from KIOW after a more than 40-year career. Cusero-Smith was also let go from the radio station and was put on administrative leave from her teaching position.
We chose to have a special board meeting today. This allows for some closure to this situation, allows us as a district now to continue to move forward and to put the focus back on the third grade classroom into our elementary building and as a district.
The resignation agreement states she will receive full pay through the 2017-2018 school year, as well as benefits offered through the school district in 2018. Cusero-Smith does have an early retirement package through the school. The package was approved by the school board on November 7th, 21 days before the racial conversation was had.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Racial tensions in Haywood High School in Brownsville, Tennessee. Racial posts on social media brought out more than 200 student protesters outside the school today. In the post, students used the N-word and made comments certain people should be hanged. Brownsville is in Haywood County, about 55 miles east of Memphis. Local 24's Tish Clark is live in Brownsville tonight, where a meeting between parents and school administrators was held this afternoon. Tish, how did that meeting go?
Well, we don't know yet, Richard. Folks are still in the meeting now. The parking lot is packed. It's between parents and some students and administrators as well. Now, we spoke with Art Garrett, the associate superintendent at Haywood County Schools. He said the district just learned about the post late yesterday morning, even though the posts were made nearly 2 weeks ago.
We thought that they were our friends.
More than 200 Haywood High School students protested outside their school demanding justice. Screenshots of racial threats posted to social media started circling Sunday. In the post, the N-word was used, and comments were made about hanging black people and white girls who date black guys. Facebook live posts have been dominating social media.
The boys, they didn't get no punishment.
The district attorney's office will not file criminal charges against the boys who made the comments. The boys could face punishment at school. Associate School Superintendent Art Garrett said the district is reviewing all the findings to determine what actions will be taken. Students say they'll protest until the boys who posted the comments are punished.
Racism is nothing new, okay? This is something we have to deal with in our society. It's an ugly part of our history. We don't want it to be a part of our future. So we're going to stop it.
Okay, and the Haywood County School District released a statement earlier today that safety is officials' number one concern. They had also mentioned that hatred and racism has no place in their school district. We'll have more coming up tonight at 6 o'clock. For now, we're live in Brownsville, Tennessee. Tish Clark, Local 24 News.
Okay, let's look at something I mentioned earlier, Snow White. What's the basic message of Snow White? Yeah, along with that, No, but I'm saying just the Snow White thing. Let's just stick with that one. There's a message in all of these little stories. What's the basic message of Snow White? And Cinderella, another story that's somewhat similar. Yes, this is the basic message. But what is the mechanisms of these messages when it comes to male-female relations? No, the message is you get pretty, and then you pretty up the house that the dwarfs have messed up, because dwarfs don't know how to keep house, because they work in the mines. See, Doc and Dopey and all the rest of them, see me? So she comes in, and she takes all the cobwebs down and all this, and she sweeps up the place. But now, since she looks at these little dwarfs, see, that's not exactly what she's got in mind, see, for a mate. So what she does is pretty herself up, and she's got something starting off with, and that is what? She's white.
Melissa and Markstown are from the same city in Iowa, but they didn't know each other growing up. That's partly because Melissa is African-American and Mark is white. Melissa says their school district was mostly white, and that helped shape her racial identity. Melissa talked to Mark about one experience in grade school that really stuck with her.
I was in this performing troupe. There was this one song that was really technically difficult, and it was a Disney princess song. It was "Someday My Prince Will Come." My mom had a friend who was a seamstress, and I think she must have gone to the fabric store and bought a pattern to make a Snow White dress. And I remember the satin, and I remember the feel of the yellow and the red and the little, you know, details on the shoulder sleeve. And I remember going up to the microphone, and I remember taking a deep breath, you know, getting all your jitters out. And I remember singing, and I did a beautiful job. I remember it went really well. And there was this moment where I looked into the audience. I could tell they were sort of laughing to each other. You know, they were like whispering, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. I couldn't figure out if it was someone behind me. And I remember I finally heard what one of them was saying. And they said, "Snow Black." That doesn't make any sense. And slowly that started to spread throughout this group. "You're Snow Black, Snow Black, ha ha ha, Snow Black." And I think for me, that was one of my first aha moments. Not in understanding myself, but I think in understanding the difference between how I view myself and how I came to learn that the world would view me. And I remember thinking, it doesn't matter to this group that I feel beautiful in this dress, and it doesn't matter to them that I'm singing really well and that I've worked really hard and that I am proud of what I'm doing. What mattered to them was what they could see and that it didn't make sense. And so they felt like it was okay to laugh and to point and to rule out those other things to consider. And That was pretty crushing for a 7-8-year-old.
Are you afraid about having kids?
Oh, in every way, shape, yeah, and form. I mean, I particularly as it relates to their racial identity, I feel so overprotective, and I don't have them yet. But working with students in a school context, you know, you read the news and you feel more terrified. And you want to build them up, and you want them to have a clear understanding of who they are, particularly Black and brown children and students. And I wish I could envision bringing them into a better world, but yeah, it's that what do we do with the one that we've got, and how do we create a space where they know who they are?
That was Melissa and Mark Stone. They were interviewed in Seattle by the University of Washington Center for Communication, Difference, and Equity. The interview is provided courtesy of StoryCorps, a national nonprofit whose mission is preserve and share humanity's stories in order to build connections between people and create a more just and compassionate world. www.storycorps.org.
Someday my prince will come.
Also, allow me to apologize to other families formed through transracial adoption, because I am deeply sorry that we suggested that interracial families are in any way funny or deserving of ridicule.
Today, on a special Snap Judgment, we're going to shake it up. In collaboration with the New York Times, we pursue a family mystery, a mystery that began decades ago. 1962, in a small suburb outside of Chicago, Illinois. But we begin a generation later, when Amy Sandberg was quite literally cleaning out her mother's closet. Snap Judgment.
As we got to kind of towards the end of the closet, up to the top shelves, I reached around to feel for anything to see if there's anything we had missed, and I found a plastic bag, and I pulled it down, and there inside the bag was a very small, white, what appeared to be baptismal dress. I knew right away it wasn't mine, because I knew I hadn't been baptized. My brothers had been baptized, but I hadn't been baptized. And I also could see that it wouldn't have fit me, because I was 12 pounds at birth, and this dress was pretty tiny. I held up the dress and to show my aunt, who was standing there with me, and I said, "Do you know anything about this? Whose dress is this?" And she looked at it, and she goes, "It's Rebecca's."
Did you know who Rebecca was?
So when I was a kid, 9 or 10 years old, one of my brothers let it slip that he had had a sister before me. So I ran into the house, and I found my mom. She was sitting at the kitchen table, and I said, is it true that you had a girl before me? I could see that she was kind of surprised that I asked the question, and took her a minute to collect herself. She said, "Listen carefully, because I'm only going to tell you this story once. Your dad and I couldn't have children, and that we had adopted Stephen and Bobby, and we very much wanted a girl, so we decided to adopt a girl next. When the baby was given to us as an infant, she was ruddy." And I remember that word very well, because I remember looking up the definition of ruddy later, because I didn't know what it meant. She decided to take the baby to our pediatrician. And when she brought the baby to Dr. Kamen, he thought that the baby was black.
This is Leonard Sandberg. The lawyer and a nurse came with the baby to the house to deliver the baby to us. It was really not a big problem for us. We had two preceding kids who were adopted, and everything went very smooth. And in this case, we assumed that everything would go smooth until we looked at the baby. We're going fine.
Did you specifically ask for to adopt a white baby?
No. Never occurred to me.
Well, why wouldn't it occur to you?
Because I assumed the baby would be white.
And when did you realize that she was black?
Immediately, when we looked at her.
What did you see?
A black baby.
And did you ask about that when they dropped the baby off?
Well, we were amazed and surprised. I was absolutely dumbfounded. Both of us, my wife and I both were dumbfounded when we looked at the baby. Obviously, that was a big deal.
Why did the baby being black concern you?
In our situation, having a Negro baby would be very difficult, to say the least. We lived in a completely lily-white area. During the time that this happened, it wouldn't have been a good idea.
Can you imagine what it would have been like for this baby to have grown up in all-white Deerfield?
It would have been very difficult. not impossible. We would have coped. She would have been the only African-American in the community. Growing up, it might have been very difficult for her.
And the boys?
And the whole family. It could have been a mess.
My mom very much wanted to keep Rebecca, that she told me that she loved her and had bonded with her and did not want to let her go. And my dad, he wanted to give Rebecca back. He wanted to give Rebecca up. My dad eventually won the argument, and that's when they decided to return Rebecca. So what my mom told me was that social workers came to the house and they picked up Rebecca. And I remember my mom crying when she got to this part of the story and having difficulty finishing the story.
Is it your understanding, am I getting this right, that it left a kind of a sadness or a darkness in your mom?
Absolutely. I feel like there was always this sort of hovering sadness. Even though she put on a good face, it seemed like she felt like a sad person most of the time.
So I've known you for 55 years, and the first word to describe you wouldn't be sentimental. But did you experience any heartbreak over the baby being taken away?
It was definitely moving, and I felt really, really bad. We then made arrangements or set out right away to get another baby, which was you.
I know this is speculative, but if it had been today, do you think you would have been okay with adopting a black baby?
Of course. No question whatsoever. I have no qualm about it.
What's changed?
Oh, the times have changed.
Can you tell me what Deerfield was like at this time?
It was small. When I was a little girl, there was maybe 12,000 residents. It was an all-white community, and it was very racially tense. There had been this housing controversy in 19-
A few years before baby Rebecca came to the Sandbergs, the town had been rocked by a pretty ugly racial controversy. A developer had made plans to build an integrated housing complex, and the majority of townspeople rallied against it and got it shut down. There was a jeering town meeting. The whole thing made national headlines. There were a few people in Deerfield who stood up in favor of the integrated housing, including Amy's parents and a local pastor. They very much saw themselves as progressives. And these people were harassed. A cross was burned on someone's lawn. The pastor, Paul Berggren, was so upset about the town's racist response that he actually made an announcement. He said he was going to adopt a black baby. And it did not go over well. This is his daughter, Deborah. She was a student at Deerfield High at the time.
I actually am looking right now at an article from 1960, and it says, white pastor in Deerfield asked to adopt Negro child. And I remember specifically that I came into the lunchroom, and as I went to sit down, these other girls said that I couldn't sit there because my dad was a commie and an N-lover. Another article that I've come across has the headline, "Warned on Adopting Negro, Minister Threatened."
They got a bomb threat.
I know my mother then became skittish about really pursuing this adoption of a black child, because what it could mean for the entire family, and was it best for that adoptive child. So I think my mother was the one that finally just said, we need to let this go.
You had brothers who were little boys when the baby was brought home, right?
Right. So they would have been about, Bobby would have been 5 at the time, and Steve would have been 8 at the time Rebecca was brought home.
My name is Steven Sandberg.
And I'm about to tell a story about a sister I had that I don't have anymore. Her name was Becky. And I don't know too much about what's happened to her over the years. But what I know about her was wonderful, but very short-lived. I can remember my dad sitting in a chair, TV chair, and I could still remember my dad getting in that chair and holding on to Becky and curled up in the chair and falling asleep in front of the TV with her. I remember my parents every night kept the windows and the blinds shut most of the time. It's like my parents didn't want anybody to know we were home. And I knew that there was trouble in the town, but I didn't understand then how it related to my sister and our family. And I just, to this day, it just feels like it just wasn't right. It wasn't normal. It shouldn't have happened. And they took my sister. It was wrong. It was all of a sudden one day, several people showed up, and my mom had her wrapped in blankets and everything else, and would let her go. They'd basically pry her out of my mom's hands, and they just didn't hardly say anything. They just walked out, and I didn't understand at all what was going on. And my mom just told me that Becky's gone and she's not going to come back. And that was it. It was very, very cold. After they left, I sat on the step outside. It seemed like for hours with my mom. I'm sorry, holding her hand because she was so upset. And all she would say is, they took my baby. They took my baby. That's all she would say. I kept saying, I'm sorry, Mom. I didn't know what to do.
Your dad seems to say it was his choice to return Rebecca, but Steve is talking as though some outside force came and took Rebecca.
I think that Steve's 8-year-old mind couldn't understand what the adults were thinking. I think he saw his baby sister being forcibly taken out of my mom's hands and people leaving with her.
When we lost Rebecca, it changed my parents. My parents traveled all over the world and were very close and loved each other very much. And when we lost Becky, I believe that it ultimately led to their divorce. We had conversations shortly before she died. And she still, on her deathbed, couldn't believe that something like that happened to her, because she was such a strong believer in treating everybody the same and equality, that she was almost like 50 years of shock that this could happen to her, and actually did happen to her, and it still affected her 50 years later. Dad and I have talked about it, and he seems to think that she was only there 2 or 3 weeks, or a much shorter period of time than I do. And I can tell you that I just don't think Dad remembers what happened. I just remember it was cold and it was spring when we got Rebecca. And I remember it was the middle of summer. It started getting very hot. I truly believe that she was with us about 3 months. And I know it was very shortly after that we got my sister Amy.
Let's touch on this. When I first told you that I was going to search for Rebecca, can you describe your reaction to that news?
I felt that it was digging up an unpleasant part of my past that I really had completely forgotten about and didn't really want to relive.
What changed your mind?
You wanted to go forward with it. It was okay.
But was it okay with him?
Not initially.
What did he do? How did he react?
he just shut it down. He didn't want to talk about it. He says, I don't want you to do that. That's foolish. And he said to me, "If I just want you to know that if you decide to go ahead with this, there will be consequences, and I will not have anything to do with you."
Whoa.
Yeah. And my brothers then stopped talking to me as well.
So why did you, I mean, did you think about not doing it?
Never.
Why did you want to do it?
I feel like at that point I was pretty obsessed with finding out if she was okay. Like, I wanted to do it for my mom, mostly. About the same time I found the baptismal dress while I was going through my mom's things, I also found a bunch of her diaries. She had written, my mom had written about thinking of Rebecca, praying for her having had a good life and good outcomes and a loving family. And, you know, it's just something that she walked around with. It was a burden that she carried. And this diary entry was from 1993. And she was still thinking about Rebecca, you know, 31 years later. And I wanted to answer that question. Like, I wanted to know that she was okay.
Amy had three clues when she began her search. A tiny picture of baby Rebecca, and a rough idea of the year and the time of year that Rebecca was born.
Well, a couple people said that it was not long after.
My husband and I went to the Cook County Law Library in downtown Chicago.
Okay, so yeah, it might be 19... So it could possibly conceivably be 62, and I would definitely go there before I go 58. But it's likely it could be May if she was adopted in April.
We went into this little room where they had several microfiche machines looking for a petition to adopt.
May of 62?
How long did you guys spend in that library?
We spent 7 hours in the library. And at 4:30, a half an hour before the library closed.
Holy moly.
Whoa. And we were almost out of here.
Jeez.
And we both saw it, like, at the same time.
Crazy.
That's funny that you just came over here.
My heart's beating so rapidly right now. Holy moly.
Whoa.
My heart's beating so rapidly right now. So we don't know if that was... So we don't know if that was her father's name or her mother's name, though. This petition right here,
yeah.
That's the petition number.
Yeah, right.
Now we have to figure out, can we get our hands on the petition?
Right.
As she gathered information, Amy worked with a woman she called the Adoption Whisperer, a kind of expert detective on all things adoption, Melissa Mitchell. Together, they narrowed down names and dates in Melissa's living room.
Smith. Angel, A-N-G-E-L-L-E, it looks like. I had a client named Angel Smith. There's probably really Angel Smith.
We then had five or six names to work with, and we started to Google each of those names and just trying to look for some online footprint of each of those people.
When I left the hospital 2 days later,
I found a blog post.
Smith has their angel. This is posted by Angel... In parentheses, angel, like the heavenly angel, Kimberly Smith. Huh? I've been angel all my life.
I think there's no doubt we have the right person here, though.
In a very crazy coincidence, Melissa, this adoption whisperer, realized she knew Angel Smith, the woman they had found. So normally it would be against protocol to just call this found adoptee out of the blue. But since Melissa knew her, they picked up the phone.
Hello? Yeah, I'm looking for Angel Smith. I don't know if you remember me or if you're the Angel Smith I remember working with. I'm looking.
So my biggest fear was that I would... my biggest fear was that I wouldn't find Rebecca, that I would search and not find her.
I help adoptees find their... Angel. Angel. I'm great, but you just are not going to believe why I'm calling.
It's going to rock your
closely
world.
Behind that, my second biggest fear was that I would find her, but she wouldn't want to be found and that she would be upset with the news that I was delivering.
She was okay.
I'm so lost right now.
I know you are. So let me start again. There was a baby whose name was Monica Gordon, and she was placed with a family in Chicago, Mr. and Mrs. Sandberg.
A white family.
Correct. Did you ever know about this?
Are you freaking out?
Yeah, yeah. I was pacing like a caged cat while Militia was talking to her.
I'm going to pass you now to Amy Roost. Yeah, I'm going to let her take over the phone now, okay?
Hi, Angel.
Hi, Amy. How are you? Bless you, bless you, bless you.
I'm shaking a little bit right now. How about you?
Girl, you know I am. I mean, I'm so excited right now. And I was in the 99-cent store waiting for my husband to come out of the doctor's office. And he's just browsing up and down the line. I left my whole basket, ran out of the store, and I'm now sitting in my car.
Oh, wow. Well.
This is absolutely. Are you sure it's me?
We're positive. So, Angel, let me tell you a little bit of the story and fill in some of the information that Melissa...
When you first got on the phone with her, like, what did you tell her at first? Were you trying to, like, ease into it?
I did ease into it.
So my parents adopted you, and they were told that your parents were both white. And you were very light-skinned, and they didn't know until a couple of weeks later, when you continued to get darker, they took you to a pediatrician, and the pediatrician thought you might be biracial. And this is where the story...
It's good.
Well, this is where the story gets a little dicey. But I want, before I tell you the rest of the story, what I want to tell you first is that in Deerfield in 1962, there was extreme racism. There was extreme racial tensions.
All over the world, it was racism. Still is.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, absolutely. But
let me just give you a hint so you don't have to worry.
Okay.
I was chosen by and for
It was immediately clear that Angel had been adopted by a wonderful family.
My parents, my mother very, very much wanted to keep you. My dad felt that it would be unfair to his sons, my brothers, and to you.
Everybody.
To you. To raise you in an all-white community in 1962.
And Angel was shockingly receptive to this news about herself.
Yeah, so I was, you know, naturally I was very worried. You're my sister, exactly.
And at some point, she said, you know, my head is just reeling and I need to get off the phone. Can we talk later? Then we eventually made a plan to meet.
Did you tell your dad?
So I called my dad, and I left a message on his voicemail saying, you know, Angel's coming to town, and she would love to meet you. I hope that you'll be able to meet with us. Maybe we could have brunch together on Sunday. And a couple days went by, and then on Saturday he called, and he said, okay, let's meet for brunch. I felt a mixture of tension and relief. And my dad's 89 and he's very fit, but he was looking very small. She went up to him and tapped him on the shoulder and held out her arms and gave him a giant hug. We were seated at our table. We ordered a round of mimosas and she began telling us about her life.
I've heard this.
Right out of the hospital.
Yes, exactly. And so I'd heard the story. I knew that I was biracial and that that my family, they had expected me to be white. Well, I didn't know that they were talking
about... You talked about how at the beginning of your search, you were wanting to see if she was okay. Do you feel like you were, like, trying to show your dad, look, she's okay? But she turned, her life turned out okay?
I mean, I did, I will say this, I did feel some responsibility for the meeting going well. I did, I remember taking some pride in little parts of her stories that I wanted to make sure she shared with my dad.
I was in private school, and she had two, we had a summer home in Union Pier, Michigan, and a home in Chicago, so she had two mortgages.
Angel hit the family lottery. After leaving the Sandbergs, she was adopted by Ruth and Harry Smith, a black couple. They lived in a middle-class black neighborhood. They owned a stationery store. They had a large network of loving friends and family.
And she shared with us about her childhood, how she had been very close to her parents and grown up in this wonderful community where, you know, she was thought of it as, you know, a village.
And then when she was 8, her dad suddenly died. She left her small private school. She and her mom moved to Los Angeles. They no longer had their village of supportive friends.
And then the story took this very distressing turn, because she began to explain how when she got to Los Angeles, she got introduced to cocaine. And
I can't honestly say that I was running from anything or hiding from anything. I just liked the way cocaine tasted.
Really liked it and started doing more cocaine and eventually ended up becoming homeless and living on the streets. So the conversation came back around to the decision to return Rebecca.
Which is how all of this happened. And I'm so grateful. I can't even imagine growing up in Deerfield, the only black
kid. Yeah, I mean, can you just imagine what her life would have been like? I mean, you imagine it, because like one
white child in the whole, I mean, the only black child in the white community.
And look at this hair.
The persecution.
It would have been a problem in this. Probably.
Not probably. Absolutely. I was very, always have been very grateful for whoever you were. Now that I know who you are, it's wonderful. You know, I always wanted to be able to say thank you, you know, because, you know, you never know how people are going to perceive things. No. And I just wanted you to know that, you know, my parents were ever grateful. I am so grateful. Huh. And it passes on to Amy. I just love her, the fact that she had the kind of heart to find me, you know, to look for me is just...
There's something about this tape that's uncomfortable, of this brunch. Can you name it?
Well, listening to the tape, you know, like I didn't feel that at, I didn't feel what I'm about to tell you at the brunch, but listening to the tape, the part that made me feel uncomfortable was, I think we were all trying to rationalize what happened. My parents' decision that it was for the best. And it may very well have been for the best. And I know Angel believes it was for the best. But I felt like there was an attempt to gloss over and make everybody sort of assuage everybody's guilt about what had taken place.
There's so much reassuring going on.
Exactly.
When you, Angel, when you knew you were going to meet Len Sandberg for that first time, did you have any hopes or any fears?
Oh, girl, no, I don't live on fear. I was so excited to be able to thank him and to what I thought would probably free him. From any type of ignorance, shall I say. When I say ignorance, I mean him not knowing me, not knowing how I would respond, how I had, you know, ingested the whole incident, the whole experience, who I had become. You know what I'm saying? I could dispel all of those notions. He would finally get to see, this is me. This is who I am. I'm really grateful. From the bottom of my heart, I am so grateful.
And are you okay with like that being on you to validate that for him? Did you feel like you had a responsibility to make him comfortable, to reassure him that you're okay?
No, that wasn't my responsibility, but I knew that it would happen. You know, it comes with a certain level of excuse me, did I make the right choice? Yeah, and especially, you know, when you're checking your moral compass. You know what I'm saying? Because it was about race. You know, we can't pretend that it wasn't. It was about race. And what does that say about me as a human being? I can attest to, hey, it was all good. It was okay. You made the right choice, dude, and I'm the only one who could have validated that for him. You know, like I explained to him, I said, hey, look, it's like this. If I were to order a dress on the internet, and then they send me, instead of sending me a red dress because I have this gorgeous red bag and shoes, and they send me a little black dress, cute little black dress, but it doesn't go with my ensemble. So it's got to go back. It's got to go back. And when I shared that with him, he was like, what? And I said,
I mean, that is a crazy thing. That's a little, I'm like, what too, Angel? Like, it's a little bit of a crazy thing to say. You were human.
Come on. Come on, come on. And I'm still human, you know? And I am still human, and I do have a brain. You know what I'm saying? Come on, seriously. You have a white family and a white community. Didn't nobody order a little black child to throw into this mix?
Did you ever for a moment not have that like positive perspective on it? Was learning this part of your story ever, I don't know, hard to swallow, or did it make you feel any kind of way?
Never. 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 You know, I was adopted or chosen twice before I was 1 month old. You know, I could be one, oh, poor me, nobody wanted me. No, it took the right people to deal with me. You know.
Black babies cost less.
Dear brothers, sisters, comrades, friends on the move, as we meet today, we are living examples of a truly remarkable movement, a movement for life, for liberation, for resistance, and yes, for love. We have fought for these things for years, and yes, we fight for it today. But let me tell you something. Your love for your brother, me, has kept me safe and sane through almost 30 years on death row. Know this, throughout it all, I have never felt alone. To the eye, I was alone in solitary confinement on death row. But the eye cannot really see all that is. For behind brick and steel, I felt your love, sometimes like a wave, sometimes like a whisper, but always there, ever present. And even when you, the people, our people, pulled me off of death row, I felt you still in the air, like a fragrance from a flower, the scent of. And when I fell into a coma, literally, when I was unconscious, you were there, literally, just a few feet away, pulling me back into consciousness and back into life, into health, and into strength. I hope you feel my love and gratitude for all that you have done and all that we will do. Love begets love. And as we march on, this movement gets stronger and stronger every day. Thank you, all of you, for being there. We are on the move. I love you all. This is your brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, December 9th, 2017. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have observations, counter-racist suggestions, thoughts on any of the segments that we heard previously. The number 641-715-3640. The code 56494. #3#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. A few things before we get to the callers. First of all, we are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, my PayPal is in the top right corner. You should see the PayPal button. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested nearly a decade of broadcasting. You can also support us by visiting my wish list at Amazon.com. It is under Gus T. Renegade. It's also linked on my blog. I also posted it on my Facebook page, Twitter as well. Thanks again for everyone who has been generous, gracious enough to support the program. I hope the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. And I hope the program has helped non-white people, particularly black people, get an accurate understanding of what it means to be white, what racism, white supremacy is, and how it works. That said, quick comments to get to. The iTunes feed had not been updating at all of late for some reason beyond my control. Could be racist interference. It was said that this was a site-wide problem that many folks, if not everyone, was having some sort of interference with uploading content. It seems that's been corrected. The iTunes feed should be current as of yesterday's broadcast, The Wisdom of Psychopaths, that should be in the iTunes feed. I checked earlier today. And this podcast, if everything is working correctly, will be uploaded within a few minutes after it's done. There does still seem to be a problem with some of the older archives not loading correctly. I'm going through individually just to check to make sure that they are working. At this point, that is a lot of content, so it will take a while to go through to double check to see, you know, that they are working. You can stream them, download them. Our content is also available at Black Talk Radio Network. Also, the current content is being posted at SoundCloud. We also have content. Mr. Fox, one of our listeners, investors in the UK, has posted lots of our content, if not most of it, on YouTube. It's available in a wide array of places online. Just lots and lots of content over the years, nearly a decade of broadcasting. But that's one. Also, there has been reports. There have been reports that some people have had problems dialing in, that they were being charged a fee to dial in to the program. That also strikes me as suspicious, could be racist interference. But you can also use, if you are not able to dial in via your phone and you want to listen, if you're on, you know, you have your smartphone mobile device, you can use the free HD app that is available. If you go to, you can use the address tinytiny.cc/1race. And that is the number one. If you use that address, you can use that to access the VOPE line. That's another way that you can call into the program. If you have a tablet, computer, whatever it is, you can use the VOPE line. But you also, if you have a cell phone, you'll see the app, the free HD app on that page. You can download that, and it's very easy to use. Lots of our listeners have used it. Some folks may be using it now. It's free, and it's basically the same principle. When you download the app, you just put in the number 641-715-3640 and the code 564-943#. If you do that, you can access the program. You can participate, or you can just listen if you just want to stream the content. But you can also use the free HD app for free if you are being charged a fee for dialing in to listen to the cows. Racist man, racist woman, racist child, usual suspects. We should be back on Monday. We just did the broadcast a few days ago talking about black maternal mortality rates and resources for expecting black parents. We will be addressing the same subject matter again this coming Monday. Black Mamas on Bed Rest. You can visit the website to see some of the great work that we will be talking about, important subject, and also because I know some of our listeners reported that they think the statistics about black maternal mortality rates, they think that's bogus. I think just 2 days after our broadcast this past Tuesday, NPR did a significant, like a 7-minute segment on that very subject matter. I posted it on my Facebook page. You can check it out. I might use it as the introduction for this coming Monday's program. But they said they think that's bogus. They do not think that black females are experiencing any difficulties or high mortality rates as a result of pregnancy. They think that that's just racist lies. I asked for specific details and didn't seem like there could have been more. But if you have an opinion, certainly this coming Monday, I will make sure to ask that question and get a response. Next, the folks down in California. I know over the years we've had a lot of listener support in the California area. I used to be a California resident myself. I hope no one is being impacted by the fires. Hope everyone is safe and not having to evacuate or worry about life, major property. Hope everyone in the state of California, all of the non-white people, especially black people, are safe. That said, when I heard that Simi Valley had to evacuate because of the fires, ooh-wee. I don't know if that was about justice, but wow. I had to contain a smile on my face when I just thought of some of the remarks that I heard. Anyway, not to dwell on that. The segment on, speaking of California, the segment on Bennett Omalu, folks should remember him from Concussion. Remember the film from 2015, Will Smith played Mr. Bennett Omalu, about all of the injuries, CTE as they now call it, impacting football players, most of them black, with this affliction, brain damage in a very literal sense. And he had a report of racism, white supremacy. He's had reports of being a victim of racism all throughout his career, even with all his academic training and everything else. Even the fact that he was not born in the U.S. does not seem to have saved him from white supremacy racism. He had a huge write-up right after that movie came out where he said that he had been trying to share this information for years, and he felt that he had been ignored and or people just took his work without crediting him for it as a result of racism. He said he felt like that's what he's been experiencing for years. Then with this, he says that the suspected race soldier sheriff is mutilating body parts, cutting off hands, encouraging he and other colleagues to fabricate autopsy reports when there is suspicion of police homicide, meaning an officer has killed someone, maybe unjustly. Fabricate the report so it doesn't, I think he was saying, change it to cause of death unknown. Wow. And this was so bad that he had to resign. And in fact, a white woman resigned from the same office and corroborated what he was saying. In the state of California. Incredible. Medical apartheid. That was one of the first things I thought of. The segment on adoption. Wow. Wow. I was reading in the paper, and that's how I found out about Bennett Omalu. I read that in the paper, and then I went to see if I could find audio to share on the broadcast. While I was checking out the news, there was also the report or a report about this black female, Miss Smith, who was adopted and then sent back. And they said, oh, yeah, you can hear, you know, the report on this. So I said, I will check this out. Wow. Black self-respect. Dr. Welsing talked about the significance of black self-respect. I cannot emphasize that enough for that particular segment. I am very curious to hear your thoughts about what you heard. I omitted a portion of the segment where they talked about Mrs. Smith's typical Negro pathologies, where they had to make sure to emphasize, or not emphasize, but they had to make sure that it was included, that ultimately Miss Smith's adoption, when she was with a black family, the black father, adopted black father, died at a pretty young age. And that obviously made it tough financially on the family. Eventually, Miss Smith was homeless. She was addicted to cocaine. She talks about how she loved the taste of cocaine. She became HIV positive, like all of the typical Negro pathologies, right? So they include that in the segment, of course. And so then that they include that, and then they end on, you know, the metaphor, the black dress has to go back. I am not saying that it would have been a wonderful thing for this white family to adopt a black child. Not a correct thing, not at all. I have spoken explicitly, consistently, harshly about white abduction of black children. That said, wow, like the reassurance that, wait a minute, even with that logic, these white people were still practicing racism. That's not even being acknowledged. All of these excuses and justifying and minimizing, and the metaphor, the black dress has to go back. On this broadcast, explicitly, the compensatory program, compensatory call-in, I request if we could not use metaphors. I've often found a lot of times racism, white supremacy is in the metaphors that we use easily, often, not even thinking about. Racism, white supremacy is there even at a subconscious level. That metaphor, it was pretty explicit. But a lot of times the metaphors, I think that's why Mr. Fuller recommends not using the phrase cream of the crop, suggesting white is on top, white supremacy, white domination. Even the metaphors often are transporting racism, white supremacy concepts. Also, racists, they use these metaphors to be very deceptive. Often they will contrast, compare two items, concepts that are not equivalent at all. They do this frequently. It is a master act of deception. Racism. Non-white people, black people, we have been exposed to this behavior for a long time. And many of us, Gus T included, we are still learning. We have not come to conclusions on particular topics. That's totally fine. But sometimes we will use a metaphor in place of logic to explain a concept, and often that just adds to confusion. If we could be explicit, direct about what it is we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. If folks could take about 5 minutes to share your commentary, that would be great. Just make sure everyone gets at least one chance to share. I'm sure we will have ample time if you have additional comments, questions you would like to add. Also, if you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. If you know other people are talking or they have the television on, or just if it's a lot of background noise, you can, you know, make your commentary and then just mute your line. That way it preserves the quality of the broadcast. Thank you kindly. With that, first few folks who dialed in, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, can I be heard?
Evening, Puff.
Hello. How's it going? Two things I want to talk about. The African American Museum just opened today in Jackson. And, you know, I just want to call out just one of the patterns in that adoption and in the African American Museum. I want to call out the white pattern. The white pattern seems to be, let's re-traumatize the victim. With that, you know, I haven't been down there. I don't know where it's going to open or whatever, or wherever. Our mayor got on TV. I live in Jackson, Mississippi. And our mayor got on TV and said that he's not going to, you know, participate because the governor had Trump come to the opening of the African Museum there. And so he didn't feel the need to participate in it. And then Trump came and all of that stuff. So I kind of stayed away from it. But when she talked about, you know, in the clips before you came on, they were talking about the museum and it's re-traumatizing. In other words, you're standing under a tree and it's dark. I mean, that whole thing just kind of, it's the re-traumatization of the victim there, you know. And then she's talking about lynching and all that, and then I thought about, you know, the Without Sanctuary. Before that, Without Sanctuary came here to Jackson, Mississippi. Their exhibit came to, I think it came to Jackson State a few years ago. It just shows just pictures of lynching victims and that type of thing. And I thought about, that's where I first thought about the concept of, you know, just re-traumatization of the victim. And speaking of re-traumatization, that adoption, they did her the biggest favor by not, you know, letting her be subjected to, you know, the whites in the 60s. To being adopted into a white family, it's not, I just don't see how, you know, whites have not only the carte blanche to just adopt any race of child, not just, you know, not just blacks, but Haitians and African children. They just seem to have carte blanche and can adopt any race of child, you know, from Hispanic to just any child. But speaking of her, you know, the adoption, the whole adoption thing, they tried to re-traumatize her. In other words, to tell her that to meet with us and let us tell you that you were not wanted and all this old type of stuff. But she did exercise self-respect as a victim, and she was not allowed to be traumatized. In other words, well, the interviewer keep adding to, she tried to add to the traumatization. Also, she tried to, oh, didn't you feel neglected? And didn't you feel? She says no, and that was, I thought that was great. I'm sorry that I didn't read that she was HIV positive, and that. But I'm sorry about that. But it just. She had a hard life. I really hate it for her, but for this, she triumphed on that end. But the other thing I wanted to say was, you know, about the metaphors. Gus, in the times you've been doing this program, never have you been more right. And this crystallized like the what metaphors mean and that type of thing. And I wouldn't have never thought of that. I mean, the metaphor was, I'm glad that she didn't allow the white people and the interviewer to re-traumatize her for the re-traumatization work. Who is me? And have her crying and have her little, you know, interviewer tactic or whatever to produce the result that they wanted, you know, with the traumatization. But I'm glad it didn't work on them and it backfired pretty much. But Gus, never have you been more right and crystallized just today, you know, the meaning of metaphors and how they don't go together at all. She tried to compare herself to a dress. Like, you can just, a baby is not something that you can, I wouldn't even compare those two things at all. And that's all I want to say. Go ahead with the next person.
Appreciate that, Puff. Metaphors, very important to pay close attention. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Hello?
Yes, your volume is a little low. We can hear you, though.
Okay, I'll try to. Is this better?
That's better. If you could use lots of Black self-respect, try to give us as much volume as you can, maybe even speak closer to the mic, that might help, too.
Oh, okay. Is this better?
That is an improvement.
Oh, okay. I joined in a little late, so I'm sorry. I didn't hear all the clips. Did you have a clip on the honoring of Major Robert Lawrence, the first Black astronaut?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Well, the Kennedy Space Center just honored him on December 8th on Friday. And I'm sure you're aware that he's the brother-in-law, he was the brother-in-law of Dr. Welsing. He died in an accident, but I just wanted to let everyone know that he was indeed honored as the first Black astronaut.
Grand, I'm posting that. I remember Dr. Welsing's sister, she spoke with us, Lauren Kress-Love, she spoke with us a couple times last year, and she talked about her brother-in-law, Robert Lawrence, and her suspicions that he may have been subject to foul play, that there may have been foul play with his death. He was training another white astronaut who I think she was saying he wasn't even qualified to be in the program at the time. And a lot of the death threats that the family got, the Welsing family got, when he died, and I mean, same time period in the 1960s, and, you know, niggers aren't supposed to be in the space program and all that. I think she said that her sister, Barbara Kress Lawrence, that she saved the letters that she used to get from, you know, people calling her, terrorizing her husband even after he died. But I'll post that. Yeah. I will even contact Lauren Kress Love to see if she paid attention to the festivities to see what she had to say about all this.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I also wanted to offer my posthumous congratulations to him. So thank you.
For sure. Appreciate that. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, Gus. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I've actually called into the show before for workplace racism, and I sent you an email. I am someone that works in clinical research. So I'm just calling in with an observation. I've been doing site selection visits and site initiation visits where we start sites on clinical research for whatever protocol we're using. And one trend that I have noticed is that a lot of physicians, because of what they're not getting paid for medical care from insurance companies, they are signing up to conduct research with very little clinical trial experience. And they're offering clinical trials to their patients for various illnesses. So this is something that people should be aware of in terms of when you go to your physician and you have, you know, maybe something a little bit more complex wrong with you, that your physician may be involved in a clinical research study for that exact syndrome or disease. And rather than just one-on-one treatment, they'll offer to put you in a research study, and they may not have a great deal of experience in how to execute that study. So that is something that Black people need to be aware of, because a lot of the clinics and things I've been to are private practices rather than hospital groups or groups associated with academia. So that's what I was calling to say.
Would the recommendation be, because I guess of late there's been a big push to say, well, one of the problems is we don't have Black people participating in these research studies because of suspicions and the Tuskegee experiment, racism, white supremacy, Black people are leery, so we need to get Black people to participate in the research studies. So would your recommendation be to not participate, or to try to get as much information as possible to make an informed decision? What would your suggestion be?
Well, there's always an informed consent form that people have to fill out. But yes, that is a big thing, that Black people are not participating in research studies. The research studies that they're seeking more Black participants on are like phase two studies, and those are phase one is the first time they use it in humans. Phase two is when they're trying to figure out the dosage. So between phase one and phase two, those are the studies that they want more Black people in, because they want that racial statistical data to figure out whether or not for this ethnic group does it work. Most physicians' offices are involved in phase three, where they're trying to figure out the efficacy, and that's where they want more Black people involved in. I would say, depending on what the issue is, I wouldn't necessarily sign my name to an informed consent, because there's the possibility that you will not be placed on the active study drug. So most double-blind studies, the decision of who gets randomized into the placebo, which is the fake drug versus the actual drug, is made by the medical monitor. But that person has access to your demographic information, so they know whether or not you're white or Black. That's where, you know, the big consideration that you have to take. Now, if you have something like cancer and this is your last chance at maybe a cure or progression-free survival, you may want to take that risk. But just know that it's not the physician that's treating you that is making the decision of what arm of the study you're in, whether or not you're receiving the active drug or the fake drug.
That's great information. Definitely something to think about. If we have other folks, I know we have other listeners who are in the medical field, if you've seen a similar pattern with regards to these research studies where Black people are being placed in the groups, I guess especially what you're talking about, where Black people are being placed in the placebo group where they're not even getting whatever the experimental drug is. If other folks have seen that pattern, if we have other people in research, feel free to chime in. That is a great one to think about for listeners.
Just to tell you, for most of the studies that Black people are involved in, from my experience, are observational studies, where you have to sign up to receive a procedure or get some type of advice. And I wrote this to you in the email a while ago. So basically it's like you're picking your own poison, and you're only consenting to allow them to watch what happens to you. Very similar to how they did the Tuskegee experiment. But more up to date in terms of it's all legal now. those are the studies that you find most black people in.
I see. Excellent information. Thank you so much for sharing that with listeners. If we have other folks in the medical field, feel free. If you've seen a similar pattern or if you have questions. Other listeners, if you dial in, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary you want to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Excuse me, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings to you, Dennis, and to the other calls and listeners. Wow, great clips this evening. The black female who spoke after Puff and Hi Puff, it's good to hear you too. It's been a while. She had actually brought up exactly what I was going to bring up, which was Mr. Lawrence. I sent you the article on that around like 10:51 last night or something like that. Because when I saw it, I immediately thought of Dr. Welsing and her sister, Lauren Cress Love, and Barbara Cress Lawrence. So I sent it to you, and I figured you probably didn't see it. So I'm glad she brought it up. I actually was going to read a brief article. It's actually the one I sent to you. I was going to read it, but I'll get into the clips. But I just wanted to pay my respects to him as well. And, you know, it just goes to show you just how hard it is to be a black person, a black pioneer, scientific pioneer in a system of white supremacy. It takes 50 years to the day of your death. You know, December 8th was when he had the plane crash. I would say he was probably assassinated by, I think it was that other German pilot. Ultimately, you know, 50 years later for you to be recognized for what you are, which is just a brilliant black scientist and all the, you know, terrorism his family had to go through. It was just horrible. So it's just great to know that he's getting the recognition he deserves. It's just shameful and disgusting and white, racist, and terroristic that it would take that long. The clip that you had played with I think it was a black female that was in a tragic arrangement, and they had the whole story of of Snow White. I just thought that was just really hard to listen to. When they called her Snow Black and were just teasing her, I couldn't imagine. I try to put my head in her space just to kind of be able to empathize. And I was just like, wow, that is horrible. Because I remember just, you know, when you're young, you're much more confused. So you'll do things that, like today, I could look back and say, man, you know, I had serious mental problems as a child, you know, running around with a Superman mask of a white man's face. And I'm a child, but, you know, I don't know any better. But, like, thinking about it, you know, white people could have responded to me no different. You know, she just happened to be the person receiving it. So I put myself in her headspace, and it was just hard to listen to. And it just really shows, I remember it was Dr. Aishaka Musa Barashango. He has a book, African People, European Holidays, A Cultural Genocide. And man, I think that story shows the genocidal nature of adopting white cultural norms and things that don't belong to us that were created by our enemies. Because it's we just set ourselves up for really horrific racist experiences that can be life altering sometimes. And to me, that was one that I think for anyone put in a position like that, a black child, that could be life altering potentially. It just was something that was quite hard to listen to. The story about the white abduction of the black child, they called her Rebecca, but her name was her name Angelique, Gus?
I think they changed her name after the original adoption was rescinded. I guess they were calling her Rebecca when she was with the white family, and then it was Angel when she got readopted.
Angel, okay. Okay, thank you. It's Angel. Okay. So, Angel, yes. It was interesting. I was listening to the white female talking about her mom and the fact that her life was never the same. And all I thought about was she wanted to abuse a black child that bad, you know, that it was something that she was dwelling on 30 years later and writing journals about. And I thought about, you know, the fact that they couldn't have children. Again, white genetic annihilation, nature getting rid of them, and the fact that what would be more normal than to have a melanated child, because that's the norm. So I'm thinking of the psychology of white supremacy and how it works in a family dynamic like theirs. And the psychological vampirism on a newborn black life, you could just see it right there. The husband, he said that not having a black female baby was a most unpleasant part of his life at one point in the story. So again, not having ownership over the black child that you can abuse at will, and having them in this terroristic environment was something that has haunted these people. Metaphor, let's get rid of that. That these people have carried and chose to speak on in ways to make it seem like it was something that they had some sort of feeling for this child that was positive, when the entire situation was just horrific. And I thought that Angel exhibited extreme black self-respect when she just made it clear, like, I understand it's the fact that this is a black baby and we're not going to have this black baby in our family, ruining the family dynamic and potentially putting us our lives in danger just based on the fact that it's a black child. So that to me, I would have loved to have Dr. Welsing around just to get her perspective, because I know she would have had quite a bit of insight on this particular story. But just powerful, and I just don't know where you find these things, but you find some really great ones. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. I thought with that adoption clip too, the dad, Mr. Sandberg, at first he said that we assumed, like when she asked him, did you all make a preference? Did you say that you wanted a white baby? And he said, no, we just assumed that the baby would be white. But later in the interview, when they were talking, it seemed as though they knew that the child was, quote unquote, biracial. And then the child got darker. And it was, whoa, 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 you know, we got to send this one back. That just seemed like a slight discrepancy in the reporting. If other folks that had a hand up, if they had commentary they wanted to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I had two questions. I think that was a Neely Fuller sound clip, and I think he was talking about Snow White, and I guess it was from that movie where I guess the dwarves, he said, was cleaning up something, and like I didn't catch what did he mention about, I guess, when she came into the house, and I guess she was trying to was she trying to dress up or something? What was it he was saying?
I believe he said that she would clean up the house and clean up herself and the house, and then she's looking for a partner, but she doesn't want, you know, the little dwarfs. She wants the handsome prince to come and, you know, take her out of all this. And the thing that she's got going for her is that she's white. I think that was the gist of what he was saying.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Like, I wanted to also point out there was a term I heard. I'm not sure which audio clip it was. It might have been the adoption one, or was another one, but that, like, the term rut was used. Like, I was thinking about, I know I had used that term for a workplace racism incident. What I was looking at in the context of it is that I was looking at some documents of juvenile arrest reports, and like on the skin description, it had freckled, it had, you know, fair, and it had ruddy. That was one of the terms. And, like, I never had heard that word before. And I guess it referred to something dark, I'm assuming. But that was the first time that I had heard that term, and then it came up again. that was another part of the audio where I guess it was at one of the schools, because racism definitely seems to be very widespread, permeating through the area of education. I guess it was some students, that some white students, that was posting something online or something, and I don't know if they went into detail about how the parents had that conversation. I think they were supposed to have some kind of meeting, and I believe that was a non-white victim who said, like, I thought that they were my friends. Like, I mean, he sounded genuinely shocked. Not like when, you know, when I hear that, like, that's what I think ignorance is. Like that clip that I heard on here one time, like, if anyone's ignorant about racism, it's black people. Like, that's an example of that. And he was, like he said he thought they was really his friends. And it's, that's very interesting that apparently he must have been talking about somebody that he, I guess he may have been talking to. I don't know if he was asking any more questions about who he was speaking of. He just said, you know, like they, you know, he thought they were his friends, and he just ended up having or experiencing a revelation of what they truly think and their behavior. And there are going to be a lot of, not even people of that age group, but people who are older or whatever the age is, that racism is dominant or white supremacy is dominant. And, you know, it's just we all need to definitely face the reality on that. And that's all I have for now. And thanks for allowing me to share.
Appreciate that, caller in Florida. That term ruddy, it's defined having a healthy red color, a cheerful, pipe-smoking man of ruddy complexion, the accompanying sentence to help give some context for how that word is used. I frequently hear that term used. I think most of the time when I hear it used, they're talking about someone's complexion, skin pigmentation, when I hear that term being used. Not always, but generally. And the confusion, I said the same thing when I heard that segment, the one he's talking about, the school in Tennessee, where the little white children, they were sending text messages talking about they wanted to hang the black students and white female students who were dating black guys, cowbell. But he said that they wanted to, or the black students specifically, he said, yeah, I thought they were my friends. And he said it was such confusion. It sounded like some real anguish. Like, this was my white friends. These was my homies. Ben, we, you know, been kicking it and listening to Kanye West and everything. And he's talking about lynching us. Like, what confusion. And that was twice in the sound clips. The very first clip that was talking about former Congressman John Conyers. They said the Congressional Black Caucus was in a state of bewilderment, confusion, anger, consistently keeping black people confused about what is going on and principally about what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, what it means to be white. Excellent. The illustration with the students especially, excellent illustration of black people being confused about what racism is. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary you want to share, if we've not heard from you at all, feel free. Your line should be open. Oh, did we miss anybody? We get everybody? All the folks who called in with a hand up, or are we missing folks? While we're waiting, make sure I get in the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Not only will we be here on Monday continuing the topic of maternal mortality rates, resources for Black mothers or expecting Black parents. That should be Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We should also be here on Wednesday. We should have another white person. Always grand to have white guests on the program. David Neuwirth, I believe that's how you say his name, N-E-I-W-E-R-T, Neuwirth, I think that's it. He wrote the book Alt America, just came out, where it's weaving in the history of white supremacy in this area of the world and how that walked us to the Donald Trump presidency currently. Just came out. He had a report. It was kind of a short article based on the book that was just published in The Guardian a couple days ago, but he should be here on Wednesday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I know one of our callers was talking about the so-called Me Too movement and all of these accusations of sexual misconduct and how all of this is going to develop. Now, Congressman John Conyers stepping down. People are probably not even going to remember or talk about with his legacy from this point forward his efforts to get reparations for Black people. It's just going to be that he, for decades, was a sexual tyrant. And those accusations might be true. I don't know. Totally incorrect if he was engaged in that behavior. But I know there are tons of whites. We talk about Thomas Jefferson all the time. That is not how they lead with their legacy, as this is a raping, racist terrorist. It's, oh, he was the president and did the Constitution and all this. And maybe we'll get to Sally Hemings and all that other stuff down the road. That is not how they function with whites. That's what it's going to be for John Conyers. All that other stuff is going to get pushed to the curb. And yep, he was a no good, lecherous, raping, sexual predator for years. And we're glad we got him out of there. We get miss any other folks? Still spectating?
Can I hear?
Yes, sir.
Howdy doody, everybody. This is Ken Steele. I am in Long Beach, California. And I just wanted to start off by saying that the fires here in Southern California, I was earlier this week in the city of Chatsworth. I think that's in the San Fernando Valley here in Southern California. That's the area that it's known as. And while traveling to this point, along the way, I saw some of the fires burning, and I thought that it was pretty interesting how just the effect of a brush fire has on a local area. The wind that was generated was pretty eerie, and the cloud covering, it was this red glowing, it was just red and glowing, and it was hot. I just remember it being extremely warm at that point. And as I'm getting closer and closer to Chatsworth, it was getting worse and worse, and I was just wondering, like, is this place going to clear up? And then it started to clear up. By the time I was done working, I stepped out and I saw that the sky was orange and black, and that I could hear a lot of emergency vehicles. You know, it didn't really occur to me what was going on at that time because I didn't see any open flames. But when I tried to leave the area, I noticed that I couldn't leave the area using the route that was prescribed to me by Google Maps. There was just police barricades all over the place, and I noticed that there were a lot of emergency vehicles just lining up in formation and then zipping off. I'd never seen anything like this. There were so many different authority figures out. I was nervous. I was thinking, you know, maybe I was going to get, you know, nabbed up or hemmed up about something, but I realized that there were just a lot of police officers, a lot of emergency vehicles, a lot of authority figures out and about. And I was really disoriented, really confused as to what was happening, because again, I just saw the orange sky. I didn't see any of the open flames. And I tried to get out of the area by a path called Foothill Boulevard. And that whole path, that whole road was shut down. And I asked one of the traffic guys, I said, hey, what's going on here? You know, I was thinking, you know, are we under some sort of North Korea warning or something like that? I just really was kind of a bit aloof as to what the situation was. Mind you, I'm from Michigan and Chicago, so I've never been in a fire type situation. I didn't know what the deal was. And he said, oh, nothing. It's just a fire. I said, okay, is this fire, is it bad, or what's the situation? He said, oh, just, you know, 160 houses have been burnt down so far. And I said, is that normal? He said, no, it's not normal. And I said, oh, okay, well, how do I get to Chino? And he said, well, you're going to have to go all the way around, and you're going to have to find a path some other way, but you know, I don't know how to get out there right now because all these roads are blocked off. And he listed a whole bunch of interstates that I couldn't get on. So, you know, at that point, I contacted a friend of mine who actually was a work colleague. I contacted a work colleague that had some information on, you know, what roads were open. And I was able to find a path, but what normally would have been a 1 hour, maybe 1 hour, 30-minute trip ended up taking me about 3.5 hours total. So the entire of Southern California, out west, I stay in the Inland Empire mostly, but in LA County and, you know, in the valley and everything, that whole place was set ablaze. And it was all the ritzy titsy areas too, like, you know, Bel Air and Malibu, and, you know, just a lot of really wealthy areas and places and hills were being affected by this rash of brush fires that just started out of nowhere. So that was really interesting. I thought it was noteworthy at how the authority figures were behaving. You know, I could see in that scenario that anything, it was kind of anything goes. I felt as though they could have easily just started pulling people over and confiscating vehicles or doing any number of things. It was just, it was very strange, very disorienting. And yeah, that was the first time I've ever been in a massive disaster. Also, I was coughing the whole time, like even on the drive home, when it seemed like I was away from the smoke and everything, I couldn't turn on my AC because it was blowing smoke from all the fires in my face, and I just it was pretty bad. I didn't really get over everything until maybe midday the next day. I didn't feel back to normal, and yeah, I feel kind of bad for the people living in these environments, and I feel really bad for the victims that are affected by this as well. I know that Tariq Nasheed was caught up in this whole thing, and he posted up videos of that. So I don't know. The fires here are very terrifying. They move very fast, and they're consuming people's homes. So what you see on the news is actually happening out here, and the images are just as cool. I think that's what I'll stick to reporting for now. I might have a few other things to touch on later in the program. Thank you so much. I'll meet my life.
Man, hope you're able to stay safe, Mr. Steele. I know they are having historic fires. I think they've said it's been like thousands of acres have been destroyed with the fires and the evacuations and what have you. The wind has made it way worse. So I'm glad you made it through that safely. I hope you're able to remain safe. I'm sorry to hear about Mr. Nasheed. I hope he's able to remain safe. No major property damage or anything like that. Again, if we have any listeners who are in that area, I hope you all are safe as well. But yeah, it looks pretty bad from the images and reports that I've seen and read over the past few days or so. They've had lots of those fires on the whole West Coast. I know they had some in, I think, the Vancouver area over the summer, and Oregon, Washington State as well over the summer. I think the whole western coast of the United States has had a lot of those fires over the past 6 months or so. We have other folks who have a hand up that we've not heard from at all. If you have a comment. Thomas in New York. Greetings, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. I'm sorry to hear about that. Well, I did see Tariq Nasheed speak about the forest fires and how fast they were evacuating people from his area. But he was back in his home, but that's a terrible situation to be in. Something I couldn't even fathom, like, it's so, like, far out, so far out of the realms of possibility living in Manhattan, you know, where there's no trees, but just seeing an area where, you know, houses are just burning. Michael Slager, 20 years on a plea deal. I mean, I don't think he was necessarily charged with murdering this man. It was something worked out, you know. He could have got between 5 and 30 years, and ended up getting 20. The way the families forgave him, even though it could be played, they weren't as forgiving in some of the clips I've seen. It was gave me that Dr. Wells and the nauseating feeling, sort of like the families after the Mother Emanuel Church shooting. The clip with the black woman who was adopted, and then I guess too black for the white family. You know, I really, man, that could maybe irk aside. You know, making those white people feel better about their racist decisions, I felt. And there was a lot of white validation and a lot of validating whites, you know, whites receiving that validation. It just was a terrible clip. I felt terrible for the lady, you know, as per what her life became in. I don't know if it would have been much better with that white family, but it kind of made me think of that clip. I mean, a guest you had before, he might have came on more than once. He had a white mother, and they tried to pass him off as, I don't know if you remember this guy, Gus.
Dave Myers, he lives right here in Washington State. Yes, sir.
Yeah, he was the only mixed-race person I've ever seen, like, really talk bad about their white parents, you know. But, I mean, after hearing his stories, I guess he had no choice. But kind of gave me that feeling about my man, Mr. Myers. Here in New York City Council, did not forced the black lady to resign. However, they tried, and the mayor kind of made it very clear way before the hearing that he was not going to take any action against her. He was very happy with the job she did. This is the black lady. She has a name that's hard to pronounce, but she signed off on getting all this money for the lead poison inspections, and the lead poison inspections were not done. Either way, she admitted and to kind of, you know, clean her thing up, where she came with these statistics showing that lead poison only affects kids 6 years and younger on a higher scale. So all the houses of children 6 years and younger were checked, but none of the other 90,000 were, which was just terrible. But either way, the next day, the federal government sent a black lady up to look into the situation, and they had a press conference. And the same lady who signed off and took this money, she blames Ben Carson for all of this. It's like he wasn't even there. Either way, I just felt like it was a lot of showcasing and, you know, have these black people fight. Now, mind you, the two white people who were fired, got to resign with all their, they resigned. Well, they were the ones in charge. They were the ones in charge of these inspections. Like, and then they were able to resign with their pensions. They're not going to jail. And they're not at none of these press conferences owning up for all of this. It's just a bunch of black people fighting over it. Have a workplace racism. which is kind of out of, you know, bounds. I was in the operating room, and as I told you before, it's an older white lady. She's not an American white. She's from Poland. And she's, I feel like she makes a lot of very sexually explicit comments, especially to a black male's genitalia. And I think I even reported that she said that she wants to work at the black hospital because she likes to see the black men naked while they, you know. Either way, she comes up to me and she asks me if I knew anyone who could help her. So I'm like, help you do what? And she says, well, she had told me the story before about her living situation and her neighbor who she can't stand. And the neighbor calls her Dirty Polak. And I said, well, what's your neighbor? She's a... She's a half Russian and half German or something, and her boyfriend's Italian. And you know, this ethnic thing works big with these white people. They're all white to me. But either way, she wanted me to have some people I know go and she'll pay them to beat this guy up. And I'm like, whoa. You know, like, oh, you know, she had this look in her eyes, like, you know, like she's dead serious about this. Like, and I'm like, well, you know, I mean, is it that she still, I don't know, I let things die down for 2 years. I haven't spoken to them, so they won't even think it's me. And I'm like, you know, I don't know anyone that could, oh, of course you do, you know. I'm like, no, I don't know anyone, you know. So I just, like, walked away, but I just felt like that was extremely interesting. Last thing I wanted to say, a lot of talk on this, of course, the opium addiction of whites. So I've been doing some research on it, and what I found, well, first, according to CBS, the drug overdoses killed more Americans last year than the entire Vietnam War did. So that's pretty big, because that was a deadly war. 60,000 people died last year alone from drug overdoses, opium drug overdoses, which I thought was compelling. I want to compare this to the crack epidemic, because I saw an article that was making a comparison to these two things. And in the mid to late 80s, I call it the crack chemical war campaign, imposed on black people, headed by George Herbert Walker Bush, the vice president at the time, on behest of Ronald Reagan. Y'all should look up George Herbert Walker, his grandfather. The death rates for overdoses in that era reached a high in America of 2 people per 100,000 people. And this was in the mid to late 80s, and it was considered an epidemic then. Now, by comparison, opioid epidemic killing 10 people per 100,000 people, 10.3 people. And in some states, the overdoses are worse than others. So the top 10 states was West Virginia. There's 41.5 people per 100 people. New Hampshire, 34.3. Ohio, 29. Kentucky, 29. Rhode Island, 28. Pennsylvania, 26. Massachusetts, 25. New Mexico, 25. Utah, 23. Tennessee topped it out at 22. Tennessee is the only state with a significant black population. Ohio has 12%, Pennsylvania 11%, but Tennessee has 17% black, which is higher than the national average. So this is definitely a white thing. And I mean, when you compare that to 2 people during the crack era to 41.5 in West Virginia, this is like, I don't know what else they're doing with their time other than shooting up. This is to show that how they're pushing the numbers up. And I make my observation based on experience on cannabis use and listening to hip hop, trying to push our numbers up. They list the heroin deaths per state and they don't include, see, they mix this up with the opioids. They don't just say, oh, this is all opioid deaths. They put it for heroin, then they have another one for morphine, another one for oxycodone, another one for fentanyl, another one for hydrocodone. And ironically, they don't list codeine, the codeine itself, and that's what the black youth seem to be on, is the codeine. So I think that that's interesting, because they're kind of excluding the opioid that a lot of our overdoses is coming in from. And we listen to the hip-hop music, all of these oxycodone, which is Percocet, and they call it Perkies in the rap, and you know, you hear rhymes about bikes and veins, that's hydrocortisone. You know, of course, the lean and the drink, that's the codeine. And I just think that, you know, the way they're doing that is terrible. I'm listening to some of these songs, and just to think of how it influenced, you know, my generation to use weed, smoke weed, and get high. I'm listening to this rapper, Lil Uzi Vert, and he's talking about Xanax, which is a not an opiate, but it's like an anxiety drug. It calms you down, kind of gives you that down effect. It's a downer, like an opiate. But he has in his song, you know, I might blow my brains out. Xanny numb the pain, yeah. Please, Xanny make it go away. I'm committed, not addicted, but it keeps controlling me. I mean, I'm listening to this, and this is, they're playing this on the radio. Like, I remember in my era, they would bleep out the drug references and some of the curses that they allow to play. And I'm listening to these young kids singing this. And I could just imagine if they have an opportunity to just take this little pill and a sip of water, if they would take it, they probably would. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Sobriety would be best. Absolutely, the chemical biological warfare under the guise of drugs, long running. Those are pretty lofty statistics, having more people die from the heroin epidemic or opioid epidemic than all of the folks who passed away or were killed during the Vietnam conflict, at least the U.S. casualties. That is striking. Wow. Do we have other folks who...
1 year. Just 1 year, Gus.
Just 1 year?
2016, more people died from the opioid epidemic than they died in the entire U.S. Vietnam War, just in 2016.
Wow. Striking statistic. Whites, and that would have to be a lofty number of white casualties, the opioid epidemic, absolutely. Did we have other folks that we missed completely? Any other folks who dialed in with a hand up that we've not heard from at all?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. This is Mahandi C. I would say, we definitely should be comfortable with the enemy dying or the enemy not being here or something that's taking out the enemy. We should definitely be comfortable with that. And I remember I was on Facebook some time ago, and one of the people posted a prayer from Mr. Gus, and I thought that was a very beautiful prayer, just basically asking God or the Creator to help Black people be comfortable. I believe he was saying be comfortable with white people leaving this earth. And I think we really need to get comfortable with that. I think we need to start praying for that. I think people need to start verbally, out loud, asking for the universe, for the Creator, to get rid of white people, the enemy that is killing us every single day in so many ways we don't even understand how they're doing it. The other thing I wanted to talk about was chemtrails. I noticed for a number of years that I've heard about chemtrails and have been following it, or chemical trails that come from the airplanes. I've noticed that they've, especially like in the summer, I noticed the planes will start coming out around, I don't know, around 10 a.m. or something like that. between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., you know, the peak times of where the sun is giving you the most energy. And that was interesting. But what was even a little more interesting to me was that I seen chemtrails during the night, especially when there's a full moon. And my sister, had told me while she was in debate class or doing her debates in college, one of the white people was telling her that they could still get sun cancer from the moonlight. And I thought that was, well, that entertained me. The other thing is, with the chemical trails, what they're doing, of course, is trying to block this, or they are actually effectively blocking a good portion of the sunlight to cool down the environment. And these chemical trails also form clouds. And then so the clouds block the sunlight. And if we could figure out a way to move those clouds out the way, that would improve our health, because we need the sunlight to survive. And it also would improve our condition, because white people die in the sunlight. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Mhandisi. People used to write in prayers as well. I had said that before. I would read some of the prayers that listeners wrote in. Folks can do that as well. If they want to write their own prayer out, we can read that on the program. We also had people who volunteered to do the prayer at the end of the program as well. I did want to say really quick, Thomas in New York, where his workplace racism situation, anytime where something like that, where you're just having simple conversation on the job with another colleague, especially if it's a race soldier, and it heads into that area where it gets to something tacky, where she goes to, I'm having some sort of conflict with my neighbor or whatever it is, and maybe you know some goons that I can hire to come and beat these people up, I would start walking immediately, because when you just stay in the area, then they can, oh, sure, you know somebody, and I just want to get some people to show that I'm tough, and we mean business, so they'll even... Just start walking like, oh, man, I can't help you with that at all. I'm going to have to talk to you later, Mary. I got to get back to work, and just start walking. It's nothing. It's no more to stay. It's nothing to chat about. Walk. That's one that I employ anytime it looks like things are going to go into that sort of tacky, non-constructive direction. Immediately, you're just walking. You say what you got to say and start walking, and do not stop. Do not break stride. Just keep rolling. Even if they keep talking, I got to go. I'll just have to talk to you a little later on. Have a good afternoon and keep rolling. Other folks that we, if we have not heard from you at all, anybody that we missed completely that had commentary they wanted to share? Do we nab all the callers or get everybody, making sure we haven't missed anyone? Greetings, Emmy. Did you have commentary?
Idea.
Yes, ma'am. Your volume is a little low.
Ooh. How about now? Is that better?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. A couple of things. I agree, I think, with Ms. Puff, with the re-traumatization. I feel like that's essentially, or there's enough evidence to suggest that that's essentially, when we talk about art, what it is, some sort of a re-traumatization process. Our genesis begins with slavery, and that's all we ever know or will know, and suffering, that kind of thing. So I agree with that. The information that the female caller, who I don't know exactly what she does, but she does, works with drug trials, that was really helpful. I didn't know, like, I didn't consider the phases. I hadn't looked into it, but I didn't consider the phases. I mean, it does make sense. You would start to make sure that, you know, your first phase would be like human, to make sure it's safe. And then I know the third phase was like dosing, which I thought was cool. So I was, thank you for that. Gave me something to think about. I could be totally incorrect. I might have missed it, but I felt like that was probably the longest, most difficult clip I've had to listen to in the compensatory call, the one with the adoption. I felt like the white people were just talking forever. And I was just like, oh my goodness. And I was taken aback by how long it appeared to me that it took way too long to get to the point. Because I kept wondering, are they even going to, like, name this person? Or, like, did they find this person? Like, what's going on? How does this end? What's up? It just seemed very long. I don't know if it's really... I don't know. I'm not adopted. So, you know, VGQ for what I'm about to say. But I'm not so sure. Like, I feel like Black self-respect could have also been not showing up. Like, what do I need to meet these people for, this man for, at all? Like, no. I mean, okay, so then if you still went, then maybe even another level of Black self-respect would have, like, I mean, just to look at him if you wanted to look at him, like, but I'm not so sure why he needs to die in peace. I don't know. I could be totally incorrect. And then the white female, I don't know I don't know what that whole dynamic was. I don't even know if the white mother even really cared that much. I feel like white people lie so much. I don't believe anything I just heard at all, other than this one white female who knows, has like no meaning for her life, decided she wanted to go and seek out this Black female who went and lived her life, albeit with whatever has happened, you know, but went and did her, was not thinking about these white people who, you know what I mean? So now she can get on a radio show. That's what I feel like. It's just been my observation that white people use Black people. I don't know. I was going to use a metaphor and it just seems so fitting, but manipulate Black people for other games. And I know that seems so basic, like, duh, but anyway. And so I was disgusted with the entire clip. And the fact that the white people were even taken aback that she referred to herself as a Black dress or minimized what she had experienced to some type of thing. I even was also wondering, I mean, like, yeah, the metaphor is not the most constructive thing, but by turning yourself into an object, I think it spoke kind of clearly to exactly, you know, what's up. Her self-objectification, I'm not saying that, you know, she was correct in that, but that's how they treated her, like a thing. And that's how we're all treated, in my opinion, like things, not people. And I agree with the other callers who mentioned like her not allowing them to pull her into a negative space about her experience. Like, kudos to that. I do think that's Black self-respect. But there was a lot of other things going on. And I really don't see what would have been constructive about having that conversation at all. Like, thank you for reaching out, but I'm good. So anyway, that was just a couple of the things. Like, I had very mixed feelings about the clip, and I was really annoyed for a really, really long time, and then just sad once she started speaking. So I was at work, and what once was a safe space for silence has now become, he wants to talk. The pharmacist wants to talk. I don't know why, but he wants to talk. But it was interesting. I'm grateful for the cows for many, many things. I've always loved questions, like even before the cows, but learning how to ask the right questions and learning how to spin it once the question, like once someone starts asking me questions and being, I don't know, like not on my toes, like being alert enough to turn this conversation back around. The pharmacist, getting to the point, I was going to say he's not white, but apparently he is. Calls himself Egyptian, and so he's giving a flu shot to some white women who ask him, so where are you from? And he says, Africa. And she goes, really? And I'm a mind my business. That's what I say, I'm a mind my business. So, and he goes, well, Egypt. And then she goes, oh, okay, I couldn't tell from your accent. So they start talking, blah, 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 blah. Well, he comes back, now it's on his mind, this conversation. And
begins to ask me these, like, very stupid questions about, well, why do people get hung up if someone asks you where you're from? And I'm like, you're either stupid or you think I'm stupid. So here we go. I was smart enough not to get caught up, but I got good information, and here it goes, so I can wrap this up. Although he is, and this is speaking to the level of confusion in non-white people, although he is non-white, he considers himself white. Because he's in that part of the world, he's allowed to bubble in white. White people don't treat him like he's white, or they're unsure of where to place him, which is why she asked. He could have said some other part that had a really like harsh accent, but she wasn't really sure. Like, she was trying to figure out, is he white or is he not white? That's the real question for anything. Are you, you know what I mean? Or not, do you know what I mean? But that's how I feel. And so it's interesting. Both of the pharmacists, one pharmacist is from Ethiopia. The other pharmacist is from Egypt. The one that is from Egypt is very light-skinned, and the one that is from Ethiopia is very, like, he's my complexion, very brown-skinned. Now, when he began to talk, I said, okay, I just asked him, I said, so are you white? And he immediately, like, his reaction let me know that he was trying to bamboozle me with a lot of talking. And then he wanted to take forever to answer the question, which is yes. Then when I said, well, how are you white? Then he wanted to talk about how he and the other pharmacists would be considered of the same race. Then he went into Christianity, sons of Ham and Sam and whomever else, and tribes of Judah and whatever. And so, but the other pharmacist is a very brown person. So then I said, so does he mark, you know, the white bubble? And then he got all, you know, reserved and whatnot. And so the whole point of what I'm saying is, number one, don't talk about race at work. The information I got was interesting. I have been ruminating on it because I've always been considering, like, who are these people who get to bubble in white in Egypt? I just met one, like, I'm working with one. So now I know he's, you know, I don't really know how all the white people respond to him, but if he's thinking he's white, I'm going to treat him like he's white. Secondly, that there's an assumption that you know nothing about anything. Play that up sometimes. And then lastly, that we're all just really, really, really confused, and it's just really, really sad. I agree with Mhandisi with a couple of things that he said over the times that I've heard him, but I do think that there's a lot of truth in saying certain things out loud, like, I can fix this problem. This problem can be fixed. Thank you all for listening.
For sure, Emmy. Appreciate that. Black female caller in New York. Did you have a commentary you wanted to share?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Gus. Greetings to all the listeners and the callers and the audience. And I just want to repeat what Emmy just said. We are all just really, really, really confused, and it is really sad. And that is a perfect introduction to what I witnessed today last weekend. I wanted to call in, but I couldn't because I was stuck in traffic again. I was in a store, and there was a black woman in the store with me, and we were just looking around at some things, and she was very, very well-dressed. Just, you know, nothing over the top, just really, really nice, just really nicely. And there was a white sales person. And apparently she had some kind of status in this store where she could get somebody to be her personal shopper. And this white woman, you know, it was her lucky day. She got to be the personal shopper for the this victim of racism. So while I was looking around, my back was turned, and I heard this white personal shopper say to this black woman, "Oh, look at you. Your shirt matches your pants exactly." And the thing about it was that it was like a shade of pink that you would never normally see. It wasn't like really pink, but it was like a grayish pink. So she hooked it up. You know that. You know how we do. So she hooked it up, and it looked really nice. She says, "Your shirt matches your pants exactly. So the black woman said, thank you. She said, and then the white woman said, and I quote, it looks really nice on you. And I'm not happy about that. She said it just like that. Immediately, it was like, I mean, every little hair on my body stood up because she sounded like some sort of serial killer. You know, so her pathology was just on display. And then she said, again, I'm really just not happy about that. And the black, me, I would have just said, no, she said something about, it makes me feel, she said, it makes me feel really bad. That's exactly what she said. It makes me feel really bad. And the black woman must have acted like she didn't hear her, or she was traumatized, or she was afraid, or I don't know what it was. But she continued to just do her shopping. And I thought to myself, had she said that to me, I would have said to her, if you're feeling really bad, can I call your manager and let them know that a customer has made you, a customer's clothing has made you feel, or my clothing has made you feel really bad? I would have came at her with a question, just like that. But the pathology of white women, who, and I've had it like up to, I don't know, to my split ends with them over the past few weeks is, it's really something that it's the sickness. And I'm kind of catching up to the readings on the book club and on the book that everybody is reading. And I'm reminded of a video that I saw, and I'll try to look for it and email it to you, Gus. The video that I saw on YouTube where Dr. Layla Africa is explaining the breaking down the biological chemical makeup of these people because of the conditions they had been in, being in the caves and being around each other, that they are incapable of showing any kind of humanism or decency or things that black people just do innately, that chemically, because of things in their blood and the amount of ammonium and all kinds of other things that he goes into. And this is the reason why this pathology is on display. This is something that is innately in them. So when I hear somebody say to somebody who's supposed to be a customer who's spending good money that this really makes her feel bad, I believe it. I believe that inside, she just, it's sickening to her. Just like we talked about the other day, how they clear their throats. They get a little piece of phlegm in their throat when they're around us because, you know, our vibe, something about us just really, really makes them feel bad. And it's simply because that we are something that they cannot be. But I just wanted to share that. And like what Emmy said, the confusion, I felt really, really bad for that, female victim of racism. And it could have been that she just didn't know what to do, or she wasn't aware that she was being targeted and being attacked, or that she just wanted to, like, get her shopping over. She did know, she just wanted to get her shopping over and get out of there. But I thought that had that been me, I would have never let her get away with that. I would have caused her some kind of, I would have made her feel even a little sicker. But anyway, that's all I had to share. And thank you for listening.
Appreciate that, black female caller in New York. I think we have heard that before, particularly white women or white people in general being disgusted, feeling bad, nauseous, not at ease when black people are doing well or even looking like they could be moving in the direction of doing well. Like if we're not in misery and suffering and just all kinds of trauma and homeless and all the rest of it, things are great. things are great. If we're singing rap songs about all of our misery and suffering, things are great. But doing well, just out trying to get a little shopping done, it makes me feel bad to see you looking so well. Just looks, even give me the idea that you might be doing well. I'm just totally disgusted with my day. I need to tell some racist jokes or figure out if we can fire a black person who works at the store or what have, or cut their hours in half for the next month. Did we miss any folks, anybody who dialed in that we've not heard from at all? The person, oh, Princess, good to hear from you. Nabbed, wonderful Nubian heritage soap from my wish list, which I adore. Did you have commentary you wanted to share, Princess?
Yes, I'll try and make it quick because I'm just now getting off work, heading home, and I have to be back to work in a few hours. I just wanted to comment because, like I said, I've just been in the middle of moving, and my landlord is a white female, and her husband is a black male, and I had texted her last week to do some work in my apartment, and when she came, I just noticed, and I was sharing it with another Cal listener, that when they both came up, first of all, she had indicated that it was only going to be, she had indicated that she was just coming up to upstairs to come see what the problem was. And so when I opened the door, her and her husband was there. So it was just like, okay. And, you know, he said hello and this, that, and the other. And, but I noticed the whole time he never gave me full eye contact. And it had dawned on me afterwards, like, it was almost as if he was trying to avoid looking at me directly. And I don't know, is that something that usually happens in tragic arrangements that these white women, it almost just looked like he was under some type of control, and like she basically just like, look here, don't talk, no this, that, and other. Like he did not give me any type of eye contact when I was talking directly to him. He was like looking the other way. At the time, he was fixing a light. A hanging light or something, and like the whole time I'm talking, it's just like he was just making sure that he kept his eyes on the light. And I didn't know what was going on, but I just thought it was weird. I don't know if anybody has experienced something like that, or any black males know anything about that, that have been in past tragic arrangements or what the deal was, because I've never seen that before. Like, he was on some serious type of mind control.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Mr. Steele.
Yes, real quick, I wanted to bring attention to some information that I came across earlier this week.
Is it possible you can raise your volume a little bit? You can speak up, maybe.
Can I be heard now?
That is an improvement.
Okay, perfect. I just wanted to inform the fellow victims, the listeners, of some information that I came across earlier this week that may substantiate some theories that were put out by Neely Fuller regarding homosexuality. It turns out that suspected white supremacist scientists have identified the genetic markers for homosexuality. These are the genes SLITRK5 and SLITRK6. And I read this in the, I believe it was the Telegraph, and it was also reported on the Daily Mail. The Daily Mail may be a dubious source of information, but it also is the most popular news source on the internet, believe it or not. So there may be some validity. And plus, it was confirmed on a few other news outlets that I saw this on. So I've triangulated the information. It turns out that these suspected racist scientists have identified these markers. Now, this is significant because if they can identify the specific genetic markers associated with homosexuality with their new CRISPR technology that they are working on perfecting, they can effectively erase homosexuality amongst suspected racists. And they can effectively render homosexuality a poor and black or non-white affliction. So I think that is what is already being primed for victims. I think that this is something that we have all observed. The heavy campaigning that the suspected racists are doing amongst non-white people worldwide to engage in anti-sexual behavior. So, you know, this is just news coming out of the UK, mostly, that scientists have outed the genetic markers for homosexuality. So how about that? And I also wanted to make a suggestion to victims of racism. In our neighborhoods, there are certain stores, convenience stores. You know, I notice this at chicken spots a lot, gas stations that operate where the attendant is behind some sort of bulletproof glass, be it the whole front counter is behind bulletproof glass, or they force you to operate behind bulletproof glass, especially after a certain hour of the night. I just want victims to consider not shopping at any of these stores. If the people who are soliciting the business of the people in the community are so scared of the community that they have to wall themselves in behind bulletproof glass, they don't need to be in the community. And bulletproof glass storefronts, not only are they psychologically damaging, they're visually unappealing, and they just lower the value of the lives of everybody that is patronizing those establishments. Even the way that you can communicate through the bulletproof glass, through that little prison talk box or whatever, is dehumanizing, and we should not allow people to feel comfortable treating us like that in our own neighborhood. So please, 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 if you do have any of such storefronts, make it an effort to not patronize those businesses and make it an effort to tell fellow victims, hey, we're not accepting this crap anymore. I'm going to go ahead and mute my line. Thank you so much.
For sure. You have to venture to the area where they stockpile black people out in Tacoma to see that sort of thing in this part of Washington State. Elsewhere where it's super, super white, they do not have those type of stores. With Princess's comment really quick. It's been my experience a lot of times, victims of white supremacy who in those tragic arrangements, the white person, whether it's a white woman or a white man, a lot of times they will exert a lot of control over the victim, the non-white person that they are suing, particularly to restrict that non-white person's access to other non-white people. They can be very controlling, sometimes in a very refined, manipulative way. When that non-white person is around other non-white people to make sure they're not doing too much talking or bringing up racism or anything that way, especially if they think it might be some competition. Like in your situation, if it's a white woman, she's with a black male, and then you're obviously a black female present, to make sure there's not any competition for her, the object that she's sexually exploiting. That's been my experience, where they can just be very controlling. And sometimes that victim can feel, you know, hey, I better watch how I'm behaving around these other black people. Better make sure that I'm not giving the impression that I'm too eager or too excited about being around the other black folks. That's just been my observation. We have about 6 minutes left. Did folks have any final concise comments they wanted to get in last 5-6 minutes?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Roz.
All right. Thank you. I'll try and make it brief. Yeah, I was going to say what I find with that, too, is sometimes the non-white person in the relationship might come from a background where they actually, even though they're with the white person, they still have some sort of attraction to the non-white group. So in order to boost the ego of the white party, of course, that's the function. And you're right with the refined psychological domination. I agree with you on that. The other thing I wanted to bring up briefly is there's a documentary, and it's all coinciding with the book study club on Charles Manson. It's called Manson Speaks. I just saw it for the first time this morning. And it's more than one part. This was part one, just came out yesterday, I believe it is. And in the documentary, they're following new killings that they believe he's done, and they're trying to solve these unsolved murders. So they find this one guy who actually took in the Manson family, and when they get to a point in the conversation, they ask him, at one point he said the Manson family had left his place in Venice Beach, and then they asked him, did they ever return? And he started to clear his throat. And I mean, clear his throat for an extended period of time, and then he refused to answer the question. So again, it validates the fact that whenever they're in a situation that makes them sick, like almost physically sick, they'll start that clearing of the throat thing. Or if they're agitated or something's agitating them acutely, you'll see the appearance of that clearing of the throat thing. So thank you. I'll mute my line to give Thomas a chance to speak. Peace, Thomas, to you too.
Oh, thank you, Ross. I just wanted to say, I listened to, I believe it was Emmy talk about the clip with the white lady who was adopted. And I was just thinking, man, we listened to the clip one way. I think how white people would perceive that clip is, and if I was the average white listener, and to hear about her life and to hear the story, I would think this black woman would have been better off raised by these racists than she was raised by this black woman who attempted to raise her. It had a tough life after the husband died. And that's what I would think that they would look at it like, you know, when they hear that story, they'll be like, yeah, look at that. You know, would have been better off with us anyway. So what Mondesi said, the lunar light, UVB light is caused, and it can cause skin cancer. And I saw a clip on YouTube where a guy was a 90-degree day, and he measured the temperature in the shade, and it got lower than 90 degrees. And then when he went outside at night, it was 90 degrees that evening, and he measured the direct moon temperature, the light, the lunar light, and it was higher than 90 degrees. So lunar light is higher. It actually has a heat resonance to it. That doesn't weigh in effect. And I believe that they can cause skin cancer from that as well. That's probably why I see them spraying at night as well, too. That'll be all I'll add. Thank you, Gus.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I just wanted to chime in on what Ken Steele said about the stores and the bulletproof glass. I remember when I lived in New York, not only did they have bulletproof glass at certain hours of the night, these other non-white, non-black people who had stores in our neighborhoods didn't even open the doors. So there's like a little spin mechanism. If you want to buy something from the store is locked, but there's this like little spin thing in the window and that is also bulletproof. Where you put your money in and you tell them what you want, they spin it in, they give it to you. So they don't even let you in. And another observation that I made about those kinds of places, they also have some that have this counter height thing, whereas they are higher on this platform than you. So they're essentially looking down at you for you to give them your money, and you have to look up at them to receive your goods. So that's a wonderful observation that he's made, and I agree that we should just not patronize those places. I'll mute my line.
I want to say every store in my area, every convenience store at 12 o'clock or, you know, depending on what time, the latest two, they lock the door and they use that spin mechanism. So you have to stand online outside the store to get something, and, you know, you spin the glass, put your money in, and they're all on an upright position. I agree with her that that's definitely true. Even as far as at Popeye's at 12 midnight, they put down the glass thing. They lift it up during the day, and then they put it down and lock it in place. So now you're only dealing with Popeye's through a window as well.
Wow. They might have drones doing that sort of technology in the future. Last 60 seconds.
Yes, I was going to say, I'm from New York, so I can agree with that. That's one thing I noticed that was different between me being in New York and North Jersey versus me being in Central Jersey is that the stores just close and that's it. And when you go to, like, Jersey City or especially New York City, you're going to find that plexiglass. Chinese food stores will be open all night, plexiglass, and it's just everything that Ken Steele said was completely accurate. I'll mute my line. And we should not be patronizing them.
Right on. With that, we will conclude the broadcast. We will be here on Monday, again, resuming our conversation on Black maternal mortality rates. I know some of our listeners think that this is another bit of racist deceit where they're lying and putting out false information, suggesting Black females are having these health problems that are not really true. So we'll make sure to explore that on Monday as well. But normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. You can check out the website for Black Mamas on Bed Rest for tips, links, suggestions. Get a preview of what we'll be talking about this coming Monday evening. We'll also be here this coming Wednesday, also at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll have another white guest on the program. Always great to take opportunities to sharpen questions when we get an opportunity to speak to racist suspects. Thanks to everyone who called in, listened. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Again, strongly recommend sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. They just had a report in the Seattle Times. It was a Black male. He was shot and killed by enforcement officials. They had a settlement where they awarded his family, I think it was over $10 million. It was substantial. That obviously does not do anything to resurrect this murdered Black person. But they were giving some of the details in the trial. And they said that, unfortunately, this victim, he was under the influence. He had been drinking just before the shooting happened. And just, again, if we can remove some of these variables that contribute to the terrorism, it's a lot of evidence that race soldiers, whites in general, they have greatly benefited and exploited a lot of Black people who were under the influence and might not have been able to make the best decisions. I think Dr. Welsing, many of the other folks that we esteem, they would strongly recommend, hey, let's be sober. Let's do everything we can to preserve our brain computer, our sanity, whatever we have left, our mental health, spiritual health. Leave all of those poisons and narcotics. Leave that stuff alone. Let's see if we can come up with solutions to solve our problems, not any sort of drugs to help us forget about our problems. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. It is the holiday season. I know they got holiday parties and all that nonsense going on. They had SantaCon today, posted about that. Another day of total debauchery in NYC. Understand, race soldiers are probably going to be out looking for opportunities to ticket Black people, particularly. Let's do everything we can to minimize that, especially if you're going to be out and about in a vehicle. Sober, and buckled up everything we can possibly do to minimize contact with the likes of Daniel Holtzclaw and other race soldiers, Michael Slager included. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Thoughts and prayers to any of the non-white people, Black people who are in harm's way in the state of California. And thoughts and prayers to Pam. Hope she is healing, recuperating quickly. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.